Welcome to episode 13-3 of the Tech Gaming Podcast. Today we got an action-packed show bursting at the seams with reader mail. We got a searing hot game impression or two. We got trivia, an interview, Indie Outlook, and perhaps a few additional surprises. So speaking of surprises, let's kick things off with our roster. On deck, we have Jeremy Lawman Lamont.
Where am I? What's going on? What's today? How... Dear listeners, thank you.
What is a man?
For being there for us. Nothing but a miserable pile of secrets that we are here to share with you tonight, live on the air. Semi-live. Semi-on the air.
And of course, there's Eric Blue Swim.
Hey, I leveled up!
And did someone start a rumor about Ryu from the Bayou? Oh my goodness, it's true. It's Sean Nolik Kirkland, ending his hiatus. To talk about, you're going to talk about some lolly role-playing tonight?
I am.
And no, I did not.
Oh my god.
Which leaves me, your humble host, Robert Desert Eagle Allen. And not with us tonight is Sage, who is at an Aikido tournament in Seattle tonight.
Kick ass!
Yeah, so let's kick things off with a contest and a reader question. UFO Interactive was kind enough to supply three codes for Mamoru-kun Curse. That's the recently released PS3 shmup. To win one, all you have to do is think up a creative name for a lolly shoot 'em up and post the moniker in the show thread.
This is going to be good.
Yes, and if you'd like to win a Comic-Con swag bag from E3, head on over to our Facebook page and comment on the fine selection of pics that come courtesy of our photographer extraordinaire, Anna Mendoza.
So, for the first contest, I think our first reader mail, yep. His name would be an excellent name for a lolly shooter.
Yeah, and that brings us to our question from Master Queef. He says, 2 weeks ago, you had some quotes from Phil Fish, and I'm pretty sure he didn't listen to your podcast because, you know, Japanese games suck. It's this type of thing that seems to make him quit the game industry. What do you think about his departure? Blue, let's start with you. What do you think?
You know, when you're in a very public industry like gaming or what have you, you're gonna have haters of all kinds. I mean, there are people who love Reggie, and then there are people that are like, die Reggie, die, and stuff like that.
Nobody hates Reggie. I don't even like Nintendo, and I love Reggie.
But yeah, I mean, you know, when you're in a public industry like this, you're gonna have to learn to kind of roll with the punches, and granted, some of those punches are really, really hard and right to the junk, but you got to be able to take it, or at least shrug it off, or mm-hmm. just stick your head in the sand or whatever and just ignore them. And because if by canceling Fez 2,
yes,
he's screwing over the people that actually did like him and did support his products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think I'm alone in this. Really, I wasn't aware until Phil Fish, until the Your Game Suck rant at GDC. For me, that opinion, that contentious opinion, was what really got me kind of talking about him. And from Fish's perspective, it seemed to get a lot of attention from gamers. And there's this whole notion that there's no such thing as bad press, which is, you know, something many people subscribe to. I don't. Majority of people learned about the designer both through Fish's portrayal in Indie Game, the movie, which, like most documentaries, especially modern documentaries, it needed to tell a story, and so therefore it needed a villain, and so it kind of vilified Fish, and both also through his internet blasts. And at the same time, I think constantly berating a community that's very active and keyed and tied into social media is just really playing with fire. Ultimately, I think the lesson is for developers. Your online persona is just as important as the actual coding. An example of that was a few shows ago, I offered an errant assessment of Jonathan Blow, and it showed that it's really hard to separate the art from the artist. And I think for smaller indies, it's increasingly difficult because many times you are the face of the game.
What was happening with, what's his name? The Earthworm Jim guy. He had a Kickstarter for a new game that was a follow-up to
Earthworm Jim. David Perry?
Never, what?
David
no,
Perry?
No.
No, other guy. I've met him. Doug Tenapel.
Okay.
Is that how you say that?
I actually think it's Tenapel.
Like the nipple? Like,
I've met him in person, and I can't remember how he pronounced it.
He pronounced it racist.
But no, it's that, yeah, exactly.
Or is he racist? He's a homophobe.
It wasn't, It wasn't, hey, look, there's a follow-up to the Neverhood. It's, hey, do you really want to support this Kickstarter because you're supporting someone with really big, support of anti-gay movements? You know, like you said, it's hard to separate the art from the artist.
Mm-hmm.
My thing about Phil Fish is a lot of these guys that you know, create a lot of controversy and have big personalities like that.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, they're not in it for the community. They're in it, you know, because they're making art. They're making what they love to do, and that experience does enough for them that, you know, they can go out there and piss people off, and it kind of rolls off of them. I think with Phil Fish,
mm-hmm.
if you followed what happened with Fez, even post release, you can tell that he just had a bad experience, and you know, there was, oh, at least I'm getting to have this shitty experience where Microsoft charges me tens of thousands of dollars for bug fixes.
That happens to many developers.
He's very public about how disappointed he was and how he didn't enjoy making this game. Mm-hmm. But
I think as a developer, especially like an indie developer, you really have to be humble. And one thing I would do is compare kind of the work of Dean Dodrell. He did Dust in Elysian Tale with Fez, and both are really standout indie titles. I'm not going to knock Fez. It's a game many people enjoyed. I didn't get to play it that much. I really enjoyed Dust. But the difference is that Dean kind of reaches out, and he's very civil. He's very polite to his audience and journalists. And Fish repeatedly attacks certain members. And as such, is someone that sees that, I'm much more likely to support people who act and behave in a respectful fashion.
I agree. And for Phil, this is more of a business. He started a business, and mm-hmm. that business has not worked out for him. And it's
mm-hmm.
That's what I'm trying to say. This isn't a labor of love for him. This is his income. He made $500,000. I don't know how long it took him to make $500,000, but.
What makes you say that, though? I mean, he's in it for a livelihood, but what makes you say that he's not in it for his own artistic? I mean, he has poured so many years of his life into making the product, Fez. I mean, you think it's just all cold business for him, just stone cold coding?
I mean, that seems to be. I mean, he puts a lot of numbers behind it. It's. I mean, that seems to be it. You know, we've put a lot of years into making my company a business, and I certainly wouldn't say I stand behind our art. I'm not doing it for the art of making touch screens. I do it because it will hopefully make us some money someday.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for some people, it's a job, and you know, you take the skills you have and you make a small business out of it. And
yeah, but the difference is
I'll be interested to see if he can figure out something else to do with his life after this. Because
should any fingers be pointed at the guy who kind of set him off, Marcus Beer? He's, what is he, the angry gamer or whatever he calls himself?
I think inconsequential.
I think his type of
bait. I mean,
his type of inflammatory clickbait, which seems to just stir up trouble. And people like him, you know, angry Joe gamer, angry video game nerd. You know, those people are like the TMZ of the gaming world. And I think, you know, most people, it would be a better place without them.
Well, I agree, except for Angry Video Game Nerd is supposed to be the...
Okay, maybe not him.
He's like tongue-in-cheek comedy.
Yeah, but whatever, Angry Joe.
Do you guys really think Phil Fish is out? Do you think he's...
No, that's what I'm saying. I don't think he'll acclimate to another job very well.
But do you think his intention is to be out?
It probably is to be out, but I think give him a couple of weeks to calm down and see all the... We want Fez 2 comments and...
Oh, no, yeah, I don't think there will be a Fez 2, ever.
Well, did
really?
Here's a question. So I've heard people compare this to, like, Andy Kaufman, right?
Right.
What if Fez 2 never was, and he was just waiting for the right time to have somebody, you know, pick on him just enough that he said, you know what, that's it. I could have made something great, but you guys ruined it.
How tight is your tinfoil hat, Jeremy?
Well, I'm just saying. Here's my take on this. I feel like not just in Phil Fish's case, but just in general, the greater community of nerds are eating themselves. I don't really understand why people are so bothered when somebody like Phil Fish or anybody has an opinion of any kind, because all of these people who are so upset about whatever Phil Fish does or whatever anybody does, they're trading these opinions back and forth all day long. Like, good opinions, mostly terrible opinions. And I don't see what makes people feel the need to like swarm up and gang up on some dude.
Is there a terrible opinion or the expression of a terrible opinion?
They're all terrible. I mean,
all opinions are terrible.
Yeah. Oh, it's just it's bad. But to me, I actually like Phil.
My opinion.
I like Phil, and I don't mind his opinions either. In fact, I think he's like an expert troll, and I think he sort of alternates between being genuinely distressed by the fact that people are so bent out of shape all the time about every little thing he does, and I think the other half of the time he's probably enjoying just trolling the shit out of people. The worst thing that I feel about Phil Fisher was it really bugged me that Fez got like Game of GDC like 10 years running, but it's not like it's his fault. I guess he's sort of kept starting over and stuff. But I feel like just generally speaking, people need to kind of chill out. Like they sort of gravitate to even bad behavior. Is it really worth getting so upset over the bad behavior of an individual person who doesn't know you, doesn't care about you, isn't your friend? What's, who cares about the opinions of these other people, these personalities? By the way, listeners, stay tuned for our next question, where we will give you our opinions of I'm just kidding. But generally speaking,
after
so
Jeremy's opinion.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, that was a joke for those of you who didn't get it. But
gotta keep the bases covered.
I think I, like most people, I mean, I had heard of Phil Fish even for the like Japanese Games Suck, which by the way, a lot of people have been saying Japanese games suck for a long time before Phil.
I've never heard anybody say that ever.
I don't think I've ever said that in my life.
I've heard that.
I wasn't sure. I was
kind of stagnant, just kind of not really evolving as well as the other ones. But I mean, that doesn't make
sense. But you could level that against Western.
That's
games.
Right. And my point is that whether there are merits to that opinion or not, like why people latched on to this dude about it, I don't know. So I had heard of him about that. And, I was like, well, that's kind of weird he would say that. But actually, that kind of makes me think of the time that, and Phil also had issues. Well, he said, everybody thinks they know me because of Indie Game the movie.
Let me go back to the Japanese Games Suck. I don't think the fact that he said it, if you go back and watch the video, of what the effect did on the person that asked the question. He was obviously bothered by that. Right. And I think that was the issue. If he had just posted that on the blog, Japanese games suck, here's why, no one would have paid attention.
Yeah, but still, I mean, that's how the internet works, right? We say all kinds of hurtful things, and just because nobody's there to give us a face reaction, like, we don't care.
I just think it's weird that he would say that Japanese games suck in the present tense when they haven't made any games since, like, the PS2, right?
Oh! But generally speaking, though, I want to comment on one thing, which is, and this is not only in the creative side of things, but also definitely in the enthusiast side of things. But during Indie Game the movie, I don't know what you guys took away from that, but the thing that I took away from it was the main groups that they focused on there were Polytron, Phil, Jonathan Blow was in it, and Team Meat.
Super Meat Boy,
Team Meat was in it, too. And it struck me that all of those guys, I mean, maybe John Blow is a little less so, but most of the things they said were, like, really, like, you kind of, like, wanted to tell them just don't say that, or, like, say it a little differently, or just grow up a little bit, and kind of watch your mouth, and it's...
But the camera's
on. The
reason
they made Indie Game the movie was to be like, hey, look at this reality show about...
Exactly, so that was the thing. So were they, like, reacting to the fact that they were on camera, and like, oh my god, now I've got to say something inflammatory? But just generally speaking, it seems like some of these younger guys and indie people, maybe, again, mostly the younger people, but they tend not to have, like, a great respect for the business process sometimes, which is super collaborative. You don't always get your way. You have to work with people to try and make things happen. You have to give things up sometimes. And it seems like they have a hard time kind of dealing with that, and they are maybe a little more vocal about those things than they should be. And I think that's the distinguishing factor for somebody like Phil versus someone like, who's the guy? Well, I was going to say someone else who is indie who's actually come from more corporate background, like
Nathan Fault.
Yes, I was trying to think of the guy from Mommy's Best Games.
Yes.
Who are very generally respectful of the fact that making big games takes people compromising.
It takes cooperation.
Absolutely.
Like, one of the big things, and I think the biggest games is art hurdle, is that any other form of art, you can boil it down to a 2-year-old does this for the first time. Like, you want to write a story, as soon as you learn how to read, you can write a story. It's not going to be good the first time.
It is the creative work of one person. primarily.
Yeah, and a video game can be, but you have to wear all these different hats. And as soon as you bring other people in to start wearing those other hats, your vision gets a little bit muddled. You know, a movie, you know, a big blockbuster movie takes hundreds of people too, but mm-hmm. you at its essence, you can boil it down to Kevin Smith and his buddies and have a black and white camera at a convenience store, you know?
Yeah. And so generally speaking, like I said, I don't have any beef with Phil or even anything he said. And generally, I feel like we as a community should try and be a little more...
less douchebaggy?
Yeah, like accommodating yeah. or just amicable in general, even if bad...
Well, why do we have to be? Why couldn't the creators?
Because we
why
are
be
adults,
a two-way street?
Right?
Yeah, everybody should be more amicable.
Yeah.
Except me, mm-hmm. because you know what, Blue? Up hey. Yours.
Oh!
He's gonna quit. He's gonna quit forever.
I quit. I quit.
Next question.
Phil will be back home.
Yes, I believe so, too. Next question comes from Dig Dug for Deagle's Friday Monsters review. He kind of explained how he watched Japanese TV as a kid. How did the rest of you get turned into semi-otaku?
When I was little, we had AFARTS, which is Army Air Force Radio and Television, mm-hmm. which you only get one channel, and it basically just different times of day plays different stuff, and it's usually about 10 years behind. So I watched a lot of Robotech.
I thought you were going to say Speed Racer.
No, Speed Racer wasn't on there. But I actually,
that would
actually
be 20
when
years.
Got, yeah. When we got Cartoon Network, I was not allowed to watch Speed Racer because when my mom was little, side story, when my mom was little, her brothers would watch Speed Racer and wouldn't let her watch because it was a boy show. So she would not let me watch because she, yeah, but I watched a lot of Robotech, that other show that I won't mention because it'll make Blue like super orgasm or whatever. And like the regular stuff like Thundercats and whatnot. And then since I kind of had that in my mind when I got older and we started getting like DBZ and I don't know, whatever other stuff we had when I was in junior high and high school. Try again. I don't know. My buddy owned my buddy's parents owned a store in high school, so then we just watched everything. Yeah.
So cartoons primarily?
Yeah, pretty much cartoons, and then like I said, in high school we watched Lotus War and
Trigun. The Japanimation.
The Japanimations. Oh, and we had the anime channel or the action channel, which played anime on Saturday nights.
Oh yeah, that was a pretty important part of my development into an anime fan too.
Yeah, there's this girl that I liked in high school who was really into anime, and she didn't have cable. And I had the action channel, and it got around. And so one day she comes up to me, and she's like, oh, my God, you have the anime channel. I was like, yeah, they played Macross 2, and I got it on tape.
Yes! Like, oh my God,
can you make a copy of that tape for me? And I was like, yeah, sure. And so I did. The tape I had wasn't long enough, so it didn't have the end.
Metaphor alert.
So my buddies and I made these dumb movies with action figures that were like ripoffs of MTV's The Real World, but with action figures. And so I waited for a really important scene towards the end of the movie, and I just stuck that on there.
Wow.
Good times.
Yes.
For me, I guess, I think my first experience with like Japanese media or movies of any kind was when I was about 4 or 5. My family was coming back from my family reunion up in New Hampshire, I want to say. And we stopped by, I think it was Walmart. And so I'm surprised at how vivid my memory of that is. And I found King Kong versus Godzilla on tape. And I'm like, King Kong and Godzilla? Wait, what's Godzilla? And, you know, I got the tape and I watched. And, of course, I fell in love with monster movies. And later on, I grew up watching the Power Rangers. I didn't know that that was, like, from Japan. Mm-hmm. Until, you know, later on. And
you know that Yellow Ranger was a dude?
Yes! Oh, that's just... You know, I actually didn't find that out until just a couple of years ago. And I'm just like, yeah. Mind blown.
And all the scenes with Rita Repulsa were from a different show entirely.
Yeah.
And that she's the voice of Laharl.
Yes, that.
She's mind triple blown.
Yes. But, because I was a big fan of the Power Rangers, you know, here it comes. Here comes the reference everybody was expecting, you know, that, you know, I, because of, you know, teen superhero shows, I gravitated towards Sailor Moon when that came over here. I think it was like in August of 95.
She was actually here earlier than that. It was just like, shit, was it, what was UPN before it was UPN? It was on Paramount channel. It was on super early in the morning. The only reason I watched it was because whenever I'd stay at my friend's house on a school night, we had to wake up super early to get to school, and that was always what was on.
That Sailor Moon was pretty much my getting ready for school routine as well, and I think I actually kind of was tardy a lot of the time for that particular reason.
Yeah, it was on like, it was on at like 4 in the morning for us. It was ridiculous.
But yeah, you know, you know, because I was a fan of the Power Rangers, you know, Sailor Moon was obviously a show that was like right up my alley, and that and Ronin Warriors and Dragon Ball Z. And
oh, yeah,
Ronin Warriors, yeah, so yeah, it's like those three shows really were what got me into, you know, Japanese animation for the very first time. And because, you know, I watched Sailor Moon and was okay with anime starring a female protagonist, I was okay with I was a little more open to trying different games, and that led me to try Mischief Makers for the Nintendo 64, and that game was absolutely phenomenal.
Ronin Warriors, though, is what got me into figure collecting, because I didn't watch that until it came to Cartoon Network, so after it already gone off the air. And I remember seeing at KB Toys, they would open up like these shops at Christmas time that were like just pop-up shops, and it would basically be anything they had in their warehouse that was local to them. And they had a whole bunch of old Ronin Warriors figures, and I bought everything.
Was Ronin Warriors the one where they had like their suits of armor and they each had an element or something, and they all got like mega powerful? Was that one? Because I've been trying to remember the name of that for like 10 years.
Yeah.
The power's in the armor.
Oh, man, that's terrible.
And then the toys, their arms were spring-loaded, so you'd, like, pull their arm back and it'd punch them.
I broke my whoever the red Ronin Warrior was figure while I was at the 4th of July. My family and I would go to the Pentagon when they were having fireworks displays there back when I lived up in that area. And, you know, I remember, you know, sitting under like an overpass, because that was like our spot every year when we went. And I remember I broke the arm off of that figure, and I have no idea how, but I was super pissed for the rest of the night about it.
The springs in those are just kind of set in there. They're pretty easy to break, but they're also pretty easy to fix. But once you fix them, they have a little wobble to them once you fix them.
What about you?
Well, I don't know if this question is more about like the anime kind of thing, because I don't know that I ever really had a special particular affiliation or affinity for Japanese cartoons or anything. But I really started with the games. From my youngest like nerdy pursuits were on the Apple II, probably when I was 4 or 5 years old, I think. And so I started out with like really Western stuff, like The Bard's Tale and Wizardry and, Wolfenstein.
That's funny. The game I remember playing on my Apple II was Bubble Bobble.
And there were some others too. Like there's games that nobody's ever even heard of that were like really formative for me.
Paper Airplane.
Well, actually, do you guys want to know like a little bit of trivia? And I've been saving this one to try and use for the Power of Good, but I think this is probably like the first strategy RPG ever. Was a game from SSI, I think, Strategic Simulations. Who even remembers that company?
I do.
Okay,
they have a little logo with an arrow, right?
Yeah, yeah. But there was a game called Galactic Adventures, which was a turn-based sort of strategy combat arena sort of game. And I remember
the Windows version of that pulled all of its clip art from like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy stuff.
Really? Because this
like
is the
icon
secret...
was that little the globe with the cowboy hat or whatever.
Can't say I remember what you're talking about, but
it was like a late Windows knockoff version of it. Like, for Windows.
I'll have to check that out, because secretly, like, if I ever got my big break as, like, a game designer or something, I would totally remake this game. But for a very first strategy RPG ever, you would manage a team of up to 10 people, and they would each have their own RPG stats, you know, health and vitality and, you know, all sorts of things. And you could, they had their inventories and things like that. And then you would set them up on a little field, and you would give them commands, and then depending on the initiative of different people, people would take different orders. So you might tell somebody to shoot at someone, but oh, they already took their turn, so they're in cover and stuff like that. It has to be the very first strategy RPG ever. But anyway, so beyond that, I think it was mostly like a normal 80s kid kind of childhood. You know, the cartoons that were on, none of us realized they were Japanese. You know, until later. And then there were kind of the American cartoons also that kind of took their, you know, like your G.I. Joes and, you know, things like that, where they would also use kind of crappy animation and stuff. And then, I don't know, it was basically always video games for me. I mean, I can appreciate a good anime here and there, but I don't know that I've got like any real major favorites. I mean, the animes that I like also are like really out there things that I'm not sure that anybody's ever heard of. I really like one called Alien 9. Which I don't know if you guys ever heard of. It's one where there's these girls in like a primary school, like grade school, but they also train them to fight aliens that come to Earth.
Uh-huh.
And they use rollerblades and stuff, and they have symbiotic okay. helmets. Yeah, do you know this?
Yeah, it sounds like... oh, wait, no, I'm thinking of another one. Very similar, though.
Yeah. So anyway, they like cut it off short. It's only got like 9 episodes or something, and it's really... Or like even less than that, like 4 episodes. Really heartbreaking. I guess there's like a manga for it, but...
That's like Golden Boy. I actually have one of the animation cells for my favorite scene in Golden Boy.
But, wow, that's kind
of
cool.
That was the same way. Like they made 5 episodes of it and then it got canceled.
Doesn't that break your heart? There's some real heartbreaking things out there. But you know, beyond that, like I said, even Japanese games like JRPGs, like everybody kind of got in on, you know, Final Fantasy VII, I think, and then everyone was like, oh my god, video games from Japan that are RPGs. But I was playing, you know, Western stuff long before that, and Ultima and things like that, so I don't know that I necessarily qualify for this. Bottom line is, I'm not sure that I'm really an otaku. Like I said, I can certainly appreciate it. I try and be a nerd of the world. I mean, because there were games back in the NES era that were from, you know, Europe and stuff, and we didn't know that. If you were playing Spy Hunter or something and the gas was labeled P, like, why is the gas labeled P? Because it's petrol. Yeah, and no one ever got that. Or Platoon, you know, you'd search a hut and there would be rubbish in it. And I'm like, rubbish? Is that some kind of radish? You know? So there, I mean, we didn't...
That's still happening, though. I have 3 European PSP games to talk about.
Yeah. So anyway, I try and, you know, a little bit of a buffet of the nerds of the world. But it definitely all ties in together. And I think, you know, and you know, playtime, too. I mean, we would play, you know, just out in my friend's yard. And we actually invented Super Smash Brothers before there was Super Smash Brothers. Yes. I would pretend to be Mega Man, and Mega Man 2 was out, so I'm going to use my Leaf Shield so you can't hurt me. Oh, I hit you first, and Mario's going to use a Fire Flower, and you know, all that sort of thing. And
did you use action figures in this?
No, it was live. This was LARPing. So we also invented LARPing back in the 80s. But so, you know, I mean, just kids, it was kind of what we had at the time. And, you know, it's still good. And I still have some of those things that are near and dear to my heart. But I don't know that I have any particular slant on, I mean, not to be racist, but I don't think I have a Japanese slant on it necessarily.
Oh, Jeremy.
So, I know.
My first, I think it may be my first Japanese game. I still own it, Dragon Warrior for the NES.
Did you get that from the... Nintendo Power promotion?
No, I think I bought it.
Sucker.
Dragon Warrior. Wasn't that the...
That's Dragon Quest.
Yeah, you're right. I think it was Dragon Quest.
Dragon Quest was its name in Japan, but they... I don't know. They changed the name.
To Final Fantasy 2.5.
So, ZZ, he wants to know, what games are you looking forward to this fall? Also, are you excited for any next-gen launch titles? Octodad.
I agree. I want to tell people Octodad, but then people are like, well, you can play it on PC. Probably, like,
no,
even
you can
right
play
now.
The first one on PC. The new one is an entirely new game.
The Dadliest Catch.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome.
I just want to listen to the theme song over and over again, really.
Yeah. That's a pretty good... Check out that trailer. See if you can find that. I mean, that is a pretty good... I mean, if you haven't heard of it, the premise... Actually, Sean, go ahead and talk about what the premise
is. So the premise, at least for the PC version, is you are a octopus that dresses in a business suit and tries to masquerade as a loving middle-class father. And the controls are really bad. Like, to move, you have to... Your movements are... If you click the right mouse button, your right leg will pick up, and then you move it, and then drop it. And then you move the other leg with the left mouse button. And that's how you walk around. So it's really hard and really doesn't make sense. But then you, like, knock stuff over and flop around.
And I think the goal is that you're really supposed to not let on that you're an octopus. Like, you're supposed to try and carry on an existence as a human father and husband.
And I guess this is the second one. I didn't get to play it at E3, but I guess you've got a romance. It's a prequel to Octodad, I think.
And there were about 10 stations.
Romance the wife.
Wow, there's a thing. That is super appropriate for this tentacle themed podcast.
Well, not romance, not capital R.
Oh. You mean woo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Woo.
So yeah, that answer to both questions. Octodad, Deadliest Catch.
I'm not sure. Let me answer the second question first. On the next gen front, I think we've talked about this before. I'm only really getting a PlayStation 4 at launch. Kind of excited about Killzone. Kind of interested to see what they do with that. I don't know if it's just going to be like another run of the mill shooter. I mean, it's kind of hard to like really get behind. Like, I'm most excited for the same kind of game that we've been playing for the last 10 years kind of game, but I really like Killzone. And that would be the one that I go for next gen. I'm still not sure what to think about some of the games that could potentially be cross generation games. I used to be pretty sure that Grand Theft Auto 5 was going to be next gen. I'm not sure anymore. I mean, maybe other people are getting more sure. I seem to be getting less sure of that.
They haven't said anything about next gen. I feel like they would have by now.
I kind of feel like they would, too. And also, looking at how just complicated the stuff they've shown for the current gen is, it's hard for me to imagine that they would have been co-developing next gen on two platforms. You know,
I would not
perhaps coming out later, a director's cut.
Yeah, I don't know.
With additional content.
So if that's the case,
I would not be surprised. I would not be surprised if at some point we find out that they had some sort of deal with Sony, that was going to be a premiere game for their streaming service, and that since the streaming service is probably not going to be ready at launch, that deal has just kind of been brushed under the carpet.
But coming out for the rest of this year, you know, Final Fantasy 14 comes out next month, or I guess by the time you're listening to it, this month. It comes out in August, I think. I was just talking to somebody on Twitter about that today, and I didn't realize it was that close. I still don't know if I can actually get into it, though.
Was this Twitter person Whip Smart Banky?
No, I don't think I was talking about it with him. I think it was Pete Davison from over at US Gamer. Who is really into it.
He's not your FF bro.
No, he's not. That's true. But the thing is, I don't know who's going
to
be playing
this. I'm telling him right now. Listen to me type. This is me typing and telling on you.
Morse code.
You know what? Whip Smart Backy and I have to play Final Fantasy XII Revenant Wings on the DS. We have a play date to play that, so I gotta crack that open at some point. Other than that, the Batman Metroidvania game that's going to be coming out on the Vita, I think, is looking pretty interesting.
We played that.
Yeah, I would not call that a Metroidvania.
No, if I thought it was
more of a straight up action platformer.
I slapped myself using that word anyway. So
it's an on rail side scroller with same combat style as Arkham Asylum.
No,
but not 3D.
Okay,
so it's kind of like a beat 'em up,
kind of, but not really.
Sonic
like imagine the combat in Arkham Asylum, except you only have two directions.
I have to play that. Sonic Lost World is coming out later this year.
Assassin's Creed 4.
Super Mario 3D World, which I've seen a lot of people talk down on. Did those people play Super Mario 3D Land? Because that was excellent. That is still one of my greatest experiences of the last two or three years.
I feel like people just wanted a new Mario experience on the Wii U.
I don't know what...
I think people were probably expecting Super Mario Galaxy 3.
Yeah,
I don't think people know what they want anymore. I mean, if there was another Mario Galaxy, everybody's like, "I want another Mario Galaxy." I don't think they'd be happy with another Mario Galaxy.
I've got some pictures of Miyamoto from E3 where he looks really sad and
he's drinking heavily.
Just generally bored. And I think that's sort of the general consensus of what Nintendo's like right now.
DuckTales coming out DuckTales is coming out next week. I think it is.
Fall's here already?
Yeah.
Fall's at the end of the month.
Oh, God.
As soon as Madden comes out, that kind of opens the levee.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the end of the month, I believe that's the rumored release date for Hatsune Miku.
That's right.
Project Diva F.
We're going to talk about this and mute the mic and go like take a dump or something.
Is that just a full-on Vocaloid game, like a rhythm sort of game, or is that something else? Is it?
Yeah.
Have you tried the demo?
I haven't. I've only played there. There was one on the PSP, I think, that I played, but it was all right.
Yeah, there's one on the PS3. It's on the PSN.
Mm.
Give it a shot. I need to go back to it.
I think that wasn't...
just disappeared, went off the radar. A couple
was
times.
It on the radar? I mean, do those kind of games make a flash? I mean,
it was on my radar. I'm sorry.
Okay, so it fell
mine too. You know, it's a shame that it's launching at $50, though. I feel like if it was like about 40 or 30, it would be like an easier sell or an easier thing to take a gamble on. But, you know, and because I'm going to wait out for it, and I know a lot of other people are probably going to wait out on it, then it's going to be considered a failure, and then we're never going to get another one over here again because it just didn't perform that well.
I mean, are you assuming that if there had been a big marketing push that it would be like a runaway hit?
I don't think
anybody's taking a chance on Hatsune Miku. It's one of those things that there is a small market of people who will buy it. If they don't buy it when it comes out, then this is going to be the only chance they ever get to buy something from the series. You did it to yourself.
I don't think you're going to get coming out on disc, right?
I believe so.
I'm surprised that it's not just a download because
I think because the people who want to buy this want to buy it for their collection.
They don't
want to play it. They already have the Hatsune Miku figures. And all their artwork that they printed out at Kinko's and put up on their wall, and they just need the physical disc. They already own the game,
something they can leak spin. Yes.
Yeah. So they just need one that's in English, so that their collection is complete.
Only other thing that has really jumped out at me that you know hasn't already been mentioned is Dead or Alive 5 Ultimate. And what's actually kind of ridiculously stupid about that is because I bought Vanilla Dead or Alive 5 this evening for $15.
Hey, how excited are you about Soul Calibur 2 HD?
Oh, I'm looking forward to seeing how that turns out because, you know, I used to main Spawn, and I don't think Spawn's going to be in. I think it's just going to be the PS2 version, so it's just going to be Hayachi.
Mm-hmm. Why are they not doing
Do you want to hear my sad story about Spawn, though?
Yeah.
So wait, was it that your whole family was killed by demons and you got powers?
No, I actually might have already told this story on the podcast, but they used to have not E for All, but a similar like traveling show to that. And it showed up in New Orleans and I went and it was the year Soul Calibur 2 came out and they held a tournament. And it was basically just you showed up, you signed up and you were in the tournament. And the winner actually won Soul Calibur. The evil one with the wings, like the full size sword.
Was it the giant one-eyed meat sword?
Yeah. Well, no, not the one Nightmare has, but the one that they show in the title screen. But yeah, it does have the big eye on it. And so, you know, I'm in the tournament. I'm doing really well because I played a lot of Soul Calibur 1, and it really is just people who showed up. This isn't like a big professional tournament. There aren't like pro players and stuff. And I get all the way up to the finals, and it's me and this other dude, and we're like right under the sword, and we're on this stage, and we play as Spawn, because that was like they pick the characters for you, and it's always the same character against each other. And they had this announcer, and he's like all up in our face and stuff, and I just cream this guy in the first round. And the second round comes up, and he's like entirely devoted to getting into my face, because that first round was just a massacre, right? And I'm nervous. And he's just getting to me, and I lost, and it like I came down to the wire. And in that last round, I just froze up, and the guy just screamed me. And so he takes him off to the winner's circle. You know, he pats me on the back, says good job, and he's like, "So, you know, we play a lot of Soul Calibur." He's like, "No, I've never played before a day in my life." I just showed up and brought my kid to this show, and I thought we'd play. He's like, "Oh, well, you just won this sword." And he's like, "Oh, I don't have any place for that." And he's like, "All right, well, your consolation prize, you can just have a copy of the game for the Xbox." And he just left. Nobody got the sword. And I was like, I could have. I was this close.
I could have had a giant one-eyed meat sword.
Yeah, I would still have it today. That would be the thing that would constantly end relationships to me for me. Because people would be like, why do you have this? It's like 6 foot by 6 foot giant ugly thing that you carry around with you everywhere.
It'd be like Hip Hop Gamer. I'm looking forward to Tales of Zillia, of course, Brighter Darkness. I'm trying to think what else. Anyone else looking forward to Assassin's Creed Black Flag?
I am. I like Assassin's Creed a lot. I'm just a little disappointed. I have a hard time getting over the fact that they've made it a numbered sequel already. There's nothing substantial about that concern. I mean, they can make it a numbered one if they want to, but it kind of bothered, like, from a continuity standpoint, they went, like, backwards and made it a numbered sequel, and it was so close to 3. Like, they didn't even do... I was sure they were going to do, like, more Connor stuff or more, you know, and they're like, nope, we're going to go back to Pirates, and we're going to call it... Because if they would have just maybe even called it, like, Assassin's Creed 3 Black Flag, I would probably even feel differently about it. But this, for some reason, that numbered sequel really gets my goat.
I think Ubisoft considered 3 a mindshare failure. Like, it was a financial success, but I don't feel like they felt like their public enjoyed Connor.
Do you think 4 is going to be like a mindshare success? I mean, do you think they're going to...
People are excited about
it. Ship-to-ship battles.
You know? Oh, no, it's going to be fun. That. Yeah, and they had it in 3 and it was fun, but... I don't know. Yeah, I am looking forward to play it, but I'm kind of...
Pokemon X, Y?
Nope,
I kind of gave up on Pokemon after... Yeah, I gave up on Pokemon after Pearl and Diamond, I think. Because I really wanted to be excited, and Pokemon in general, I've sort of had this weird artificial enthusiasm for, probably since, you know, like 1996. But I don't know.
I still have fun with the games.
They're fun. You know, they're all right.
It's the same game. It's just slightly recontextualized, but, you know, at first I think it's just going to be Pokemon, but all of a sudden the addiction just kicks in.
See, I'm the opposite. I'm like, oh, I'm excited. It's Pokemon. I'm going to do it. And then I get like 6 hours in and I'm like,
I don't even get that far. The only reason I enjoyed the last one was because Deagle and I went to McDonald's.
You know what I did a lot, though? I sort of creeped the Toys R Us free Pokemon events.
Yeah.
Like an adult dude, and they had like kids there getting posters and stuff, and I'm like in the corner with my DS Lite. I don't even know if they still do. I actually parked outside of a GameStop once, just didn't even go in, just parked close enough that I got their Wi-Fi signal, got the event Pokemon, and left.
Oh, see, with Animal Crossing, they figured out how to game that. I bet they do it with Pokemon now, too.
Hopefully.
Pokemon hasn't been the same since, like, the original 151.
Actually, it's always been exactly the same.
I think the problem is you play your first one, and you get a favorite. And the idea that you can't get that favorite is irritating.
Yeah, they say...
I love Squirtle. And the fact that I'm going to buy this game and there's like a 0.001 chance of me ever seeing a Squirtle is disappointing.
Who's everyone's favorite third-gen starter? That's
third-gen? Is that the one with the fire pig?
Yeah, I think he's a fire monkey.
Oh.
Monferno? Maybe he's the evolved form. Turtwig, anyway, is the right answer.
Who's
the blue and green?
Blue is... some crappy Pokemon. The correct answer is Turtwig.
Thanks. Turtwig. I'm standing right here.
Yeah.
That crappy blue.
Turtwig is the right answer. That's awesome.
I think we evaded where Jeremy answered. Next generation games? I'm still looking forward to Forza 5, and especially after seeing Drive Club. I have almost no faith in Drive Club at all.
I mean...
Not need a racer.
I mean, it looks nice, and I know the Turn 10 team is... a really strong track record for, no pun intended, for making solid racing games, but, you know.
I've got a racing wheel. I'm all in on Drive Club.
Jeremy, you're...
I'm predisposed. I love it already. 10 out of 10.
I got bored. I played three laps or three rounds against other people, and by the fourth, I was like, you know, I was waiting for Sean to stop playing Invisibles, and I was like, it kept looking over my shoulder. Sean, are you done yet?
Oh, is this Gran Turismo?
No, this was Drive Club.
Drive Club.
That's the PS4.
Yeah. Whatever, I'm going to talk about Invisibles here in a minute. Let's get.
I still have my unopened copy of Invisibles with the camera, because you told me to get it, and I still haven't opened it yet.
So let's move on to impressions. Sean.
Oh, you want me to go first?
Sean, kick us off.
So speaking of Invisibles, John Mack from Sony Entertainment Europe, the guy who I talked to Invisibles about, at E3, I was telling him, yeah, I really like the first one.
Is that different than John Mack from Queasy Games?
I know. Actually, John Mack is not his name either.
Oh, I see.
His Twitter handle.
Oh, I see.
But I told him, you know, like, I really like the first one. The second one was really rare out here, and I didn't get it, and I was kind of bummed out about that. And he said, don't worry, I'll hook you up. And yesterday, I got a package from him. It was second game and the third game, which I didn't even know existed because it didn't come out over here. And they're quite good. If you like the first Invisibles, they've still got the campy... full motion video cutscenes. They got a bunch of new games in there, a bunch of new Invisimals.
This one's for Vita, right?
No. The fourth one is for Vita. That's the one that's not out yet.
Okay.
And I'm pretty excited about that one too. There are a lot of really cool new things with that because you don't need the card. It uses the Vita can sense depth a little bit better.
Yep.
So you can make your Invisimals giant in a park if you want to.
Did you say PSP or? You Vita. Said Vita. You play this on the Vita? They sent you. Are there card? These are card versions of the Vita games.
No, hold on.
Oh, you're just talking about...
Sent me the PSP games.
Uh-huh.
I played the Vita game at E3.
Oh.
Yeah. I see. So there's a Vita game and a PS3 game coming out.
That was Sean's big smile moment.
Yes. I was pretty excited.
Yeah.
I see, I can understand that. Because remember you guys, when we did that one show and I talked all about Facebook games and Outernauts? You remember that? And I'm really on board. Like, I really want a good, like, Western interpretation of Pokemon. So I can understand Sean's enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And apparently, like he was telling me, he's like, it's huge in Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me trading cards. He's like, yeah, sorry, we don't have these printed in English yet, even though we're an English studio. It was really important to get the Portuguese and Spanish versions out first, because those are the two countries it's biggest in.
Weird.
So I don't know, it's weird, but I don't know, I enjoyed it. But the reason I brought it up, other than to say thank you, was because I upgraded to a PSP 3000. Wow, what a terrible out-of-the-box experience those are now.
Really? Oh, you mean just compared to
what it used to be. It used to be you opened it up, you plugged it into a PC or a PS3 or whatever, and you downloaded games to it. And now it's, you open it up, it doesn't come with a memory card anymore. But it actually still has a little divot in the box where the memory card was supposed to be, just to remind you that, like, hey, guess what we took out. It doesn't come with a headphones or the little remote thing anymore.
The microfiber cloth.
Yeah, it doesn't come with anything. It comes with the PSP and a charger.
Right.
And then you plug it into your computer, and it makes you download all this software, and then it's like, psych, this software doesn't work with the Sony Entertainment Network anymore. Any games you want to download from now on, you have to do it directly on the PSP. Which takes forever.
Mm. Can still do it
on
also, PS3.
I haven't tried that yet, but you can't do it through a PC anymore. I like the PC because it was easier for me to keep to manage.
Are you
my
sure
games.
You can't? Because it's still when you go to the new web store on PC, it still gives you an option to download.
Right. So what you do is when you click that download thing, it's supposed to open up the downloader app.
Uh-huh.
That you download that's still on their website, but it doesn't anymore. Instead, it says it takes you to a link that says, here's how you can download this game to your PSP. First, go to the PlayStation store on your PSP.
Oh, really?
And go to your download list. Yeah, you can buy the game, and then it'll show up in your download list, and then you open it up your PSP and download it that way.
Well, Sean, I'm a little mad at you. I bought a 3000 at launch, and I told you explicitly not to buy one.
Yeah, but the reason I upgraded was because I also got a capture kit, mm-hmm. and I needed one that could use the component cables, and the 1000 doesn't.
Mm. Hey,
because the rendering of the screen on the 3000 just drives me nuts.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask. Was I've always been curious about these like sideways pixels or something that they do there? Can you tell what's been your experience with that?
Yeah, you can
now that we're in like 2008 or whatever, whenever this was, but
and when the 3000 came out, they said you can play directly in the sunlight, and that's what I showed Sean because I bought one. I said, "Oh, cool! I can finally play PSP outside." And I showed him. I said, "That's total bullshit.
You can't even do it with a Vita.
If you take the case off and play it without a case, yes, you can. The screen itself is bright enough." But the super high gloss plastic that they make the case out of reflects 9,000% of the sunlight.
So there's the 3000 hack you've been waiting for.
Also, the disc door is flimsy and it sounds like a jet engine when you're playing games off the disc. But
if it wasn't the only one I was able to find, I probably would have gotten one of the older models as well.
Get a go, seriously.
I was rocking my 1000 this week, playing Valkyria Chronicles 2 again, just because Sean was going to be on the show.
In honor of Kirkland.
Well, I played Yggdra Union.
Yggdra. It's Nordic.
Yeah, in honor of Deagle, because it was only $3, and that game is not bad. Yeah, it's a little weird that I'm 8 hours into it and just now learning very core concepts, which is kind of bullshit. But they do some interesting enough things with SRPG kind of standards. They make the boards really, really small, so you really have to plan out your moves ahead of time, yeah. Which is cool. I think they take really simple concepts and make them too complicated. Like, instead of giving you health, they give you morale. And so you get into a fight and you have 8 dudes and you watch your 8 dudes fight these other 8 dudes. And eventually one side will win and one side will lose. But that's not what judges whether or not you die. It's how high your morale is. And it's weird. It would have just been easier to just say, hey, these people attacked these people and did this much damage.
Right. Advanced War style.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But they don't do that. And it's weird and confusing. It took me like 3 chapters to figure out, okay, this is actually what's going on.
Did you ever play End War on the PSP?
Not on the PSP.
That turn system, I couldn't wrap my head around. Speaking of confusing nonsense.
I have a $2 copy sitting on my shelf unplayed.
Play that. Try to figure it out. Try to wrap your head around the turn system. I don't get it.
Maybe I will. I actually like the PS3 version. I think I might be the only person that liked it. But
it's not bad. Didn't you play Knights of the Nightmare too?
I played halfway through the tutorial and was like, I'm sure I'll enjoy this someday, but I don't want to sit through. The way they break up the tutorials in that is dumb because it breaks it up into 20 different chapters. Right. Each chapter covers one concept. Mm-hmm. And the first concept is like, how to push the X button. So it's not even moving. And so it'll take you through 4 chapters of like really super basic things. Like, this is the concept of a health bar. And then the 5th chapter will be, all right, so we're going to review all of those things. And it's like, fuck you. I will do this some other time. And then I started playing Agar Union, and I'm happy with that.
Alrighty.
Yeah. And I played Walking Dead 400 Days, but none of you guys did, so I don't want to talk about that.
Oh, it's really good. I kind of want you to talk about it.
It's 5 different chapters with 5 different short stories.
And I've heard the whole thing is like an hour and a half.
Yeah. I mean, it's about the same size as one of the other episodes.
How much is it?
$5.
Free if you buy the new Vita.
So talk about it a little bit.
So they're... how do I talk about it without spoiling it?
Well, you'll have to do that anyway, even if we had...
How is it different from the previous?
Well, so previously, you follow Lee, right? You have your one character that you're following, and he interacts with all these secondary characters. And this one, since it's 5 different stories, it all kind of intermingles.
Is it 5 different points of view that's simultaneous? Like Rashomon
style? Basically, it takes place over 400 days. So, for example, there's one, it's a guy who's on his way to prison. And that takes place 2 days after the, you know, patient zero or whatever. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, there's one where you're this high school kid and it's like 250 days after that. But the end of the game the episode when they all come together, I think that is day 400. So at that point, you see them all together. You know what they've gone through. You don't necessarily know how they got to that point. But you know that they somehow all got together. And it's really cool. And
it's the same general game idea, right? Talking, adventure game, make choices.
Yeah, and you make some pretty tough decisions. And there were definitely some decisions that I made that I wish I didn't make, but I think the cool thing about that game is once you make a decision, being man enough to live with that for the rest of the season.
Yeah. Well, and just to make sure I understand, they carry some things over from season 1 and they will continue to carry things from this into season 2. Is that the promise that they're making, or am I assuming?
There is one moment that if you played season 1 a certain way, there's a payoff in this episode, but it's not a big payoff. It's actually a payoff that I wasn't looking for it, so when it happened I didn't notice it, and then somebody else was like, yeah, there's this one part where I was like, oh my god, that's so and so, how did I not see that? But other than that, it's pretty detached from it. I know it will use your save file from the first season in some way, which means there probably will be some sort of crossover, but I don't know what it's, I mean, nobody knows what it's going to be. And I'd rather not know what it's going to be, at least for a while. I will say the end of the season, or the end of the episode, you can extrapolate how they would run into the other cast.
Let me jump on board then.
Do it.
So it's no secret that Dragon's Crown was one of my most anticipated games. I was a big fan of Grim Grimoire, Odin Sphere, Muramasa.
I got Odin Sphere on the PlayStation Network 2 this week, past week.
Oh, good for you.
Yay.
You took my advice. And I did play a little bit of the import version of Grand Knight's History, which came on a used PSP Go. I got from GameStop. Thanks for the nudie pics. Those were well worth it. Anyway, the combination of beautiful, just hand-drawn art and competent play mechanics. The mechanics didn't quite measure up to the beauty of it, but it was still a formula that spoke to me. It really captured my heart and wouldn't let go. And with Dragon's Crown, it seemed like Vanillaware, they really wanted to build the ultimate brawler. They wanted to remedy many of the things that kind of plague the genre. They're a little outdated. And I'm happy to report...
They really fixed the one problem that I always have, is that characters, usually you can either see their butt or their boobs. Okay. And they really twisted their spines enough that you could see both.
I would like to shout out to Escher.
There
Girls.
Is a mermaid where the way she's in the water is just kind of amazing. I'm not going to talk about boobs or butts, but I am...
Later.
Okay, yeah. I will later. But I'm happy to report, for the most part, they really succeeded. But at the game's core, I do have a few niggling issues. So first of all, beat 'em ups can get a little tedious. You walk west to east, conquering everything that stands in your way, kind of like the story of the United States, only reverse. With Dragon's Crown, the direction is the same, but there are doors you can enter. You know, they're dungeon alcoves. Sean and I, we played the E3 demo, and you know, you could find things like doors, treasure chest, and there's these twinkling little stars to show off the location of the treasure. To open and explore these areas, you can use the right stick to move an on-screen cursor on the PS3, and then you use touch on the Vita. At first, I thought it felt like a dumb clicky, but then you realize it's tied to your level score, which I'm pretty sure it does feed into your experience. And so, you know, there is some payoff to it. And the reason I say pretty sure is that Dragon's Crown, man, the game is complicated. Not so complicated, it's impenetrable, but there are just so many different systems. Loot, for instance, is given at the end of a level, and there you have the option to either sell or take it all, or you can evaluate. There's A through E letter grades that are used as an estimate to appraise certain pieces, and unlike other games, appraising everything will quickly put you in the red, so you have to be careful. You know, appraisal also raises the value of loot, so you know, you have to take these calculated gambles. Beyond that, there are skill trees. They're not trees, they're actual cards that you choose that are both character specific and ones that are open for everyone. There's equipment management because your gear depreciates. There's monster elemental weaknesses. There's choose your own adventure elements in the storyline, which could definitely be improved, because there are sequences where it wants to put you on a game over path. So you're, you know, there's a sequence where you're sentenced to a dungeon for a month, but then you don't see a game over screen. It just kind of puts you back. And so, and there's not much foreshadowing of which way to choose those. There's probably at least 15 other mechanics I'm forgetting. You can go to the cleric and you can pay a different amount, and that will give you kind of a perk, you know, bonus, all these little things. At the heart of it all, though, there's fighting. And that's kind of the problem. The game runs at a fairly solid 60 frames per second, even though the benchmark doesn't quite hold on the Vita. The Vita, you know, is a great port, but there's a little bit of slowdown there. There's a nice variety of attacks. You can aerial, you can juggle foes, you can ground pound. In combat, it mainly uses the square button with a directional press of the analog stick, kind of like Smash Brothers. When you use the circle, that releases the super. And so far, that's really the only use of the circle button. Right now, I'm playing as the Amazon. I call her Amazon.com, I think is the name
so
I gave her.
You are playing as the boob and butt.
Yes, I am. Well, on the initial selection screen, in my defense, and I'm also playing as the knight, on the initial selection screen, they say for novices, for advanced users, and both the knight and the Amazon.com are recommended for novices. So anyway, her aerial attacks are a little bit clunky.
The detail boobs. Of the cellulite on her butt.
That really threw me off, man. Like, I have to kind of, like, look away a little bit. Like, she has this weird... I don't think it's cellulite, but it's, like, this weird, like,
chunkiness.
Angly thing. Yeah,
right. She's
like,
a little chunky, yeah.
Oh, yeah, anyway, carry on. We'll talk about this in a minute.
She's Rubenesque. How about that?
I'm just saying they went through a lot of trouble detailing that.
But you know what? I'll say this. When she does a ground pound, her bottom gets rather shapely. All the chunky stuff goes away. And there's a little pantsu when who is it? When the sorceress gets knocked over. Okay, I was trying to avoid that. Why did you guys push me over?
I think we have.
That's what that game is about. That is what that does. When you play,
it's more than that. It's more than that, guys. Anyway, you can buy cards that give you a little bit more control. I'm talking about kind of the aerial attacks were a little bit clunky for the Amazon, and you can add, of course, more moves. But the control isn't as responsive as I'd like. And one of the problems is the block button is the same as the attack button, and you engage that by holding it down. And as such, it's not quite fast enough. Dodging is accomplished with R1, but occasionally you get locked into a character animation, so there's no insta-cancel. And so the fighting isn't quite as responsive as I like. Now, Sean, when we played the game at E3, he took issue, I think, with the game being too visually busy. And the demo...
The characters were too big.
Okay, characters were too big, and then they changed in size. And the demo that we played had four characters fighting multiple monsters. Now, at the time, I had a little bit less of a problem. The game itself is scalable. You can take on quests by yourself. Occasionally, you're given a forced AI assistant, but most of the time, you can decide on your own party. And then you'll find these piles of bones in dungeons that can be resurrected in adventures with unique names, levels, equipment sets. But although it's easier to make sense of what's going on with just a single player, non-fighting AI drones, when you take a full party, it means you're not the only damage sponge, and the CPU characters, they do a pretty good job at attacking, but they don't do such a hot job at avoiding traps, like my gang would routinely walk on fire on traps and things like that. So I did see a little bit of a problem. There's some areas where I was fighting pirates, and there's a shit ton of pirates on screen, and I kind of lost sight of my character once or twice in what was going on screen. Although there's a ton...
I have one question.
Yes, Sean.
I understand there's a correct answer to this question. Dragon's Crown or Streets of Rage?
I can't say both.
Nope.
See, I've got a question.
Desert Island, you can only play one of them.
the original Streets of Rage? Or Streets of Rage 2.
Let's do Streets of Rage Remix.
I'm going to take Dragon's Crown.
Okay.
And I know you're going to be unhappy with my answer.
Dragon's Crown or Chronicles of Mystara?
Oh, Dragon's Crown.
Really? Because I feel like this is very similar to Chronicles of Mystara.
It is.
Like, I wonder if Capcom is really like, whew, we got out ahead of that one.
Yeah, they are.
Because it's like exactly the same kind of thing.
Okay, the combat's the same, but what really pushes it above and why it's better than the games you just mentioned is all those other mechanics, like you can spend time in the menus, and it's vaguely like, and this is kind of a stretch, vaguely like Disgaea, because you go in these different menus, and each of these have a separate mechanic that you can, you know, immerse yourself in. You can play with your equipment, you know, you can you level up your character, you can do all kinds of different things. And so those elements... What's that?
So, but these ladies are of age.
Maybe. So anyway, all those stat-based mechanics are really cool. And that's what makes, I think, Dragon's Crown easily, I'll say this, one of the best brawlers in the past decade. That puts me on safe ground.
Wow.
And if you're a PS3 and Vita owner like Jeremy, you're short on cash, unlike Jeremy, you want to take, and you don't care to take advantage of the game sharing function, which is super easy. On the title screen, you can upload your file. Every once in a while, there's games that don't make that intuitive, but this game is really easy.
Cross-platform, or cross-play, uploading.
Yes.
Cross-save?
Cross-save.
Cross-save. What did I say?
You said game sharing.
I'm sorry.
Which I've kind of been waiting to come back. Like, I hope there are some game sharing games at some point, but I guess everything has demos now these days. So
yeah. I'm sorry. No, I meant to cross save there. But anyway, I'd say the PS3 version is the one to get. The
Actually,
console.
Do you have cross play also? Can you play?
I don't think so. There haven't been many people online. And when I was playing a few people online, they would just kind of get up and their character wouldn't do anything. Like they'd go make a sandwich, which is really annoying. So
crossplay.
The matchmaking was pretty good, so I could kick them off. So anyway, the console version, a lot of simultaneously on-screen sprites. That said, the Vita version's no slouch and definitely a commendable port. Okay, Pantsu, questions?
Shima Pan or no Shima Pan?
Oh, blue. Okay, we'll move on. How disappointed would you guys be if I told you that Mars Warlogs wasn't about firewood from the Red Planet?
6.5.
Oh wait, I think I might have bought this on Steam.
Did you? Didn't even know you were on Steam.
Yeah, I haven't played it there. Super okay. cheap, and so I could do that.
So Mars Warlogs is a tale of innocence. It's actually told by innocence. Innocence is this young English lad. He's a criminal who refused to become a pawn in a war and subsequently was jailed. And during the game's introduction, he's about to get raped by a very obese man and is saved by Temperance. And I don't mean self-denial. I'm talking about Roy Temperance.
He's and the then perfect. It's a Final Fantasy XIII crossover and Hope shows up.
Yes. Via Virtue.
But does lightning.
Oh, you guys. Anyway, are you confused yet?
Yes.
Let me sort it out for you. Here's the short pitch.
I can't tell if this is a giant euphemism for something.
It may be. It's Assassin's Creed combat meets Fallout. Maybe the dialogue tree's a Mass Effect. The best thing about the game is the melee-oriented battles, which require you have to parry, you got to break through guarding enemies, you invest in skill trees. There is the stealth, the technomancer, and brawler are the choices. And that keeps the game interesting through it's about a 10-hour playtime. Less interesting is the dialogue and story, which shoehorns in profanity and rough subjects just to be edgy. That's why I mentioned the initial rape scene. Wants to throw in, you know, F-bombs here and there to try to capture the player's ear. To the game's benefit, they're a French developer, Paris-based Spiders. They did listen to players. They redid the dialogue and voice acting, which many people thought were substandard, and they re-recorded everything. So that's very commendable for a small outfit. My problem with the game is that I also have, and this may be a very subjective thing, I have with movies and games set in prisons, in that the player or the viewer feels like they're trapped, very claustrophobic. For Mars, there's a relatively small area that you run around in. It feels like a six-room condo. You complete your quests for a good amount of the game, probably the first third. Not only is there a very small space, but there's little payoff when you're poofing around. For me, I really enjoy kind of the sense of discovery and the temptation to wander off the path to pursue, you know, whatever interests me in more of a sandbox. So with this one, you know, there's fun to be had. The $20 price, the normal price, not sale price for PC, and the 360 versions is a bit high. It's coming also to the PS3 for you, Jeremy. So I'd recommend curious types kind of wait for a sale and keep their expectations in check before they head to Mars.
Get Your Ass to Mars reference there. Don't Get Your Ass to Mars.
Is that Total Recall?
I think so.
Okay.
I can't totally recall, but...
I bought that book, Total Recall.
The Arnold Schwarzenegger book?
Yeah.
How was it?
I haven't started reading it. Oh,
it is a memoir of my life. I went to Mars.
Isn't it his birthday today?
How do you know that, Blue?
Happy birthday.
I think I saw Zack Ryder from the WWE tweeting about it.
Oh, God.
Hey, are you going to watch that documentary about Jake the Snake Roberts?
No, not yet. Which one is it?
Well, I don't think they've made it. I think they are making it now, but he's making a... He's trying to make a life comeback.
Yeah, he's been doing really good. He's been with Diamond Dallas Page trying to get his life back on track. And he kind of relapsed a little bit, but he caught himself. He had two drinks a couple of weeks ago, and he's like all pissed off at himself. And it's going to be interesting to see if he can stick to it.
I hope so. That was my favorite wrestler back when I was little, Sean.
Dude was a master of psychology.
He had a snake.
I remember it bit Savage once. And it was on like a Saturday morning TV show, too.
Was he the one who got sprayed in the face with arrogance?
He's the one that had a snake.
I remember somebody was like, somebody got sprayed in the face with, who was the guy who had the big perfume bottle?
Rick the Model Martel?
Maybe. I don't have very many wrestling memories, but I remember the one time somebody got sprayed in the face with... Because it was labeled arrogance or something, and he would spray himself with arrogance. Somebody got sprayed with arrogance. I felt like it was Jake the Snake, and I thought he went blind. I remember being little, and I'm like, oh my god, he's blind. You don't come back from getting sprayed in the face with arrogance, I guess.
That's some kayfabe.
Yes. Should I tag in?
Yes.
Well,
jump in the ring.
A certain streak has ended, and that streak being the streak of not buying anything for the 3DS.
Oh, I thought this was going to be like a Seinfeld sort of.
Also, Blue got laid.
Basically, the last time I got a retail 3DS game was actually at my birthday last year. I got Super Mario 3D Land, which is awesome. Mario Kart 7, which is okay. And Kid Icarus Uprising, which was also awesome.
Very good.
I was in Target and I saw the limited edition of Project Cross Zone.
Yes.
Sitting in the case, and you know, I thought, yeah, I'll get myself a birthday present because I've been kind of thinking about it, but I wasn't too sure because, you know, I know some people didn't get the limited edition. I know a friend of the show, Deco Gunmetal Jackal, was not able to get the limited edition when he went to pick his copy up. So I jumped on it, and this has been a really weird RPG for me because with RPGs, usually the appeal is like the story and the characters, and the gameplay is just kind of okay. I mean, there's nothing. If you compare it to something like a Ninja Gaiden or whatever, RPG gameplay can be a little bit on the boring side. Usually I'll just exaggerate with this, suffer through the gameplay for the sake of the story. And with Project Cross Zone, I feel like it's in reverse because I love the gameplay, you know, the SRPG, yeah. You know, Disgaea-like gameplay. I love that, and I love the interactive combat sequences where you have to kind of time your button presses and your cross attacks and whatnot to get the most damage and the least amount of misses and whatnot. But the story's leaving me cold.
It's complicated as all get-up.
Yeah, I mean, it's like 10 hours.
It gets increasingly convoluted as she goes.
I've also heard that the combat, once you figure out the single one combo that you use with every single character, you just do that every time you attack somebody for the rest of the game.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's...
There's still timing elements there.
Yeah, I mean, if you accidentally hit a button you've already entered, you know, you have the attack button along with forward, back, up, and down. And if you accidentally hit this same attack button twice, then you won't be able to do all of the moves in the combo and get the extra one attack.
Hey, but once you get muscle memory down for doing that every single time, then...
You bring in different partners that you tag in also.
Yeah. And each cross attack is a little bit different, so you have to figure out, you know, if I can't do this attack when when I'm doing the crossover because half of the hits are going to miss and stuff like that. I mean, you know, from a gameplay perspective, I'm really enjoying it, but the story is just, I mean, it's batshit insane. 10 hours in, my main party had about 29 characters in it. And each one has to get in just one line of dialogue and
single
cutscene. And it's just, God, it just drives me nuts.
I hate when games have an ensemble cast and they can't decide who's going to be your favorite character. So they just have every single character respond to everything.
Yes. And I mean, it's just, you know, Bond from Fighting Vipers, you know, he'll have to put down somebody's idea just to get one line in and just remind you that he's still there.
Mm-hmm. You can, like, every time I see a scene like that, I imagine the boardroom meeting that took place where they wrote it. It's like, so this character didn't have a line. Oh, well, then put in an ellipses somewhere so we can at least use this art we made up for him.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing that really pisses me off is that in addition to every character having to say something, is that like when a new character appears, they'll have to do this. Oh, it's a surprise mystery character. I wonder who that is. And then, surprise, it's someone from this game. And they must have done that about two or three times. Just in the first, like, five main chapters.
Yeah.
It's, and, like, the first like, five chapters are a tutorial. And the tutorial lasts 2 hours. Now, granted, it's a hell of a lot better than the tutorial in the demo, which was just text block, block after text block after text block, and you get so damn annoyed you just skip all the way through them. But, you know, I mean, 2 hours of, you know, teaching you how to play the game, I mean, it's okay. And I feel like it actually gave me a really good understanding as to the gameplay mechanics. But, you know, just when you have, you know, the same dramatic reveal over and over and over again, and you aren't even at the 12-hour mark of a 60-hour game. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's like you start to zone out a bit. And
how much better would it be if they would have used Mega Man from Mega Man Legends instead of Mega Man X?
Honestly, I haven't even gotten to Mega Man X yet. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm at the, well, slightly spoiler alert. I'm at the 20-hour mark, and I haven't seen him yet. The only character I have encountered is, from Mega Man, I believe, is Tron.
Tronbo.
Oh, she's in it.
Yeah, her combo kicks ass.
Mm-hmm. I love the characters and the music. Like for instance, when Sir Arthur would come, they would play the Ghouls and Ghosts music, and he would have his attacks, and the guy, I forgot his name, from Die Hard Arcade, Bruce Willis.
Oh,
Dynamite Deku.
Yeah, yeah. he would use the grandfather clock attack, and, you know, it pulled from all those different games, and so that was, to me, so much fun. I couldn't believe how much that they fit in on a 3DS card.
It's fantastic as far as fan service goes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, the characters themselves are really good. I mean, it's such a nerdgasm when you have, you know, Ryu and Ken from Street Fighter talking and fighting alongside Akira and Pai from Virtua Fighter and Jin and Xiaoyu from Tekken. To a fighting game nerd, it's just
right.
You
almost expect the plot line to be stupid, because how do you get so many, what is there, at least 70 plus characters?
Oh, God.
You know, how do you get them all together? How do you weave that, write a storyline that kind of makes sense? I mean, and for me, it was like the storyline just jumps from here to there, and it just bounces all over the place.
It's like walk into an office and... Ooh, hey, where the hell are we now?
Walk into a time portal and, hey, we're on somewhere else. We're on another universe. So, it's understandable for them to bring that many characters together.
Yeah, and, I mean, maybe it's just me, but I feel like they kind of, like, front-loaded the character reveals a little bit. Like, they should have spaced it out a bit and maybe did, like, oh, there's, like, this party with a certain amount of characters, and then you play as them for a couple of chapters, and then you jump over to like Dante and Dimitri and their group.
They're a good couple too.
Yeah, it's Victor and... I mean, some of the combos that they come up with, and also it's like how the characters will interact with each other, like the secondary characters it's like sometimes they'll have lines that that just talk directly to the main pair of characters. I mean, in many ways, it's a great game, but the story just leaves me flat. I mean, I feel like I'm just tolerating it, really.
Yeah.
And one last thing that irks me a bit is like...
Did you enjoy, because for me it was like, oh, seeing this person kind of interact or acknowledge that they exist. Like, going back to maybe Sir Arthur, it was like somebody from another game completely was aware of his presence, was aware of his existence. And because he's kind of older, they would make jokes about that, or, you know, show a little bit more reverence, or, you know, they'd make jokes about him being in his underwear. Or, you know.
See, I feel like that's why I'm sad that we never got Sega Gaga.
Mm-hmm.
Because the references I've seen in that are pretty amazing. Like how Alex Kidd is basically the receptionist or whatever because he's shamed the company.
Some
cross over and meet Master Higgins.
Some indie studio needs to make like a modern day version of Sega Gaga. Where you're like anybody, like we were talking at the top of the show about how everyone's so super critical and like, oh, that company's so stupid, and you know they should be doing it this way. Why can't they see that it's so easy? Somebody should make something where you get to run like EA or something or Zynga or something, you know, or so, you know, some stand-in company for that. Yes, or whatever, and like just deal with the fact that, you know what, all of your customers are bitchy all the time. They don't care what you do. You can never do anything right.
They should totally make a game dev story add-on where it adds social media to it. So it's like real life. Every time you have the reviews, and it's like, this game is okay, this game is great, this game is really good. And then like the Twitter responses, everybody just says you're terrible.
Yeah.
like a Saints Row parody of game dev story called Game Devil Story or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, one last thing that that irked me is like, you know, the characters would be surrounded by dozens of enemies. I mean, we're talking as many as like two dozen that just randomly appear out of nowhere. And they will just prattle on and on for like 5 minutes, and they're just expecting the enemies to just sit there and go, oh, yeah, you done yet?
Have you played a lot of SRPGs?
Well, you know, I mean I can understand, like, you know, talking at the beginning of a battle or, you know, like at the beginning leading up to a battle, but like midway through the battle and like more characters spawn and they talk for like 10 minutes, I can't see that happening. It kind of breaks the illusion.
It's the Bond villain thing. Nobody kills Bond, right? They gotta talk and tell him how he's going to die and give the big reveal, the plot reveal, and then allow him to kind of die on his own unsupervised.
Yeah, that's been my big issue with Edgar Union is you'll get all the way to the end of a mission and then die and then start the mission over again, and every line of dialogue you have to sit through again because you can't skip it.
You can't fast forward.
A lot of dialogue. What?
You can't fast forward?
No. Well, you can kind of. You can cut them off from finishing the vocal line. Like right. You can cut the voice actors off, but you actually have to watch all the text scroll by.
Okay.
I should just be able to press start and then move on to the next part where there's not talking.
You should.
Definitely.
Blue, tell me about Gran Turismo 5 XL.
Well, Gran Turismo 5 XL is a re-release of Gran Turismo 5 with $20 of downloadable content. And the best thing about this is that the game itself usually costs about $20 or less. So it's already a good deal right out of the gate.
So it's got to be what, like cars or what's?
Yeah, it's a car pack. I believe some driver gear. I haven't really.
How about new tracks?
Did they? I was gonna say I don't think they sold tracks.
They have a couple of tracks. I think they have Montego Opal? Double Ring or a Twin Ring. Mm-hmm. I think it is. The tracks that come with XL, I believe, are two go kart tracks. Yeah, the go-kart's a hell of a lot of
go-karts
fun.
Go-karts are way fun. It's pretty crazy, but, you know, the only thing is that it doesn't, in Gran Turismo 5, and I'm hoping that they fix some of this stuff in Gran Turismo 6, like some of the janky, weird stuff, where you switch your main vehicle over to be a go-kart, and then you go back to do, like, Suzuka Circuit or something like that, and you're still in a go-kart, and it's like, oh, you can't race in this. Really? Because I'm pretty sure I can. But yeah, go-karts are way fun in that game. No turtle shells, though.
Yeah. It even sounds like the old Super Mario Kart go-karts.
Yeah.
I'm sure they probably, you know, sampled it or whatever, but, you know. But yeah, I mean, the sound of the go-karts in Gran Turismo, it was such a throwback to, like, I think, like, Mario's kart specifically in Super Mario Kart on the SNES. And I'm like, oh, I missed that sound.
Right. That or Jimmy Johnson, anything with an engine.
You know, it's funny too, because they show your driver and he's in like this whole getup. Do they have professional go-kart drivers who get in the like the helmets and the tinfoil, you know, racing suits and things like that?
Yeah.
If they have hot dog eating contests, they gotta have go-kart racing.
Yeah, I guess they must. There must be some professional go-kart circuit somewhere.
Yeah, with XL, you know, there's like two go-kart tracks that are included for arcade mode. I'm not sure if they're in the main career mode, GT mode, I believe it's called. One of the cars included with the DLC is a car called the Red Bull X 2011. I think it's a concept car or something like that. And it is a game-breaking DLC car. And here's why. So with some of the older Gran Turismo games, you couldn't race certain cars in certain races because they had too much horsepower. They'd have like limits, like you can't have a car above 486 horsepower.
Well, it would put them in a different class. It would be go from like the B class to the A class, right?
Yeah, sometimes. It's been a while since, you know, I played some of the older games, but you know, there was like a horsepower restriction.
Yeah.
And with the X 2011, this thing has 1500 horsepower.
Wow.
And goes, I don't know what the exact max speed is. I haven't been able to find a stretch of land long enough. But I've had the thing up past 250 miles an hour. And I had this thing, in, you know, Gran Turismo, the GT mode has an A-spec and a B-spec. A-spec is you racing the cars yourself, and B-spec is you playing pit crew chief and basically directing your driver to, you know, slow down a bit, you know, pace up, pass this guy. You know, it's very limited. So, you know, it's something I'd like to see expanded upon, you know, in Gran Turismo 6.
Right. I was just going to say that. I really hope, because it's kind of a neat idea, but they've talked a lot about second screens and stuff, and I would like to see a more robust B-spec.
Yeah.
Something that feels less sterile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, you know, I mean, on the one hand, you know, you have the benefit of just being able to set the controller down and just let him lap everybody, which, I mean, you know, you're playing the Gran Turismo World Championships, and he is lapping people. You know, I mean, it's, you know, the game, that car destroys most of the challenging races because, you know, you just, it's too damn fast. And it's, and on top of being fast, it's super responsive. It's got great handling for a car that goes that fast, and braking is great. I mean, it's a kick-ass car, but the problem is it's too damn good for the rest of the game, and it just kind of breaks everything. But you know, I mean, it's been a lot of fun just sitting back and just letting my driver, you know, rake in the cash.
Yeah, is the DLC on disc, or do you have to download that?
It does come with a code.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wait. Are we supposed to be mad that it would be on disc or that it's not on disc? I forget which we're supposed to be outraged at.
Not outraged. Release... Curious.
No, I'm just saying. I'm sure that there are people there who are outraged about it.
Well, for people that don't have an internet connection, maybe.
I am outraged.
If they're in a nuclear sub.
For those people, they have an original Xbox.
Well, you know, I think the I want to say that XL has like some of the later patches included with it, or the patches up to a certain point included with it. I could be wrong. I did update a lot, and I don't know what was a part of it. But I want to say that the DLC tokens were just, you know, 100 kilobytes. So even if you're on like dial up, you'll be able to download them rather quickly.
I thought those were your bed springs, Blue.
Oh no!
Streak has ended.
No, those bed springs do not get any sort of a workout.
I like to jump on my bed. That's pretty good.
Yeah. If I jump on my bed, I'll probably kill the frame.
I have a lot of spontaneous pillow fights, though.
But and I've also had a project car in GT5. You see, a couple of years ago, I built a model of a 1971 Ford Mustang Mach 1.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since I built that model, it's like, you know, I'll put it on top of my PSP games or just some random place in my room where I have room for it. And ever since then, I've bought that car in any game that it's available in. You know, I think I have it in Forza 4, and, you know, I bought it in Gran Turismo. And the problem that I was having with it was, you know, I think it's like a four-gear car. And, you know, on turns, you know, acceleration was good. In some of the lower class races, I was, you know, getting ahead of a lot of people. But when, like, a straightaway came, I would be getting past like I was standing still, because once you get it up to like fourth gear, that's like it maxes out at like 110 miles an hour, and then it kind of drops down to like 106, and then it's back up to 110, lather, rinse, repeat. So I kind of made it like my project car to make that car not suck as much. And I've managed to get the miles per hour up to 133 or 134 before it starts maxing out. And, you know, I put an aero kit on it. I put the spoiler and the, I think it's a front aerodynamics kit on it. So it's just like the model I built. And, you know, I've got it up to like 133 or thereabouts, but I don't want to put too much horsepower and redo the engine, because I believe it's a, like, you like rebuild the engine or upgrade the engine and there's no going back. You're stuck with it. And I don't want to put too much horsepower in it and then have the car become like a total pain in the ass to like get around a corner or brake or whatever. So that's been a little bit of a challenge for me. And
you forgot to paint a racing stripe on it. That'll make it go at least 10 miles an hour faster.
Well, this one, it's, you know, I picked a black car with a silver hood, and I think the spoiler on it is silver as well, and it looks pretty badass. But yeah, that's just been a little fun side project I've had going with it, and it's been a pretty kick-ass car. Even to just watch it in the B-spec mode, it's been a blast. But that's pretty much my gaming week. Jeremy, what have you been up to?
I have been sort of all over the place in the, you know, few weeks since we've done a show, but most recently, I'm just saying, I had to go back a little bit. couple of things that I've been playing. A game that came out on PC quite a while back, but was recently released on console and on the Vita, well, on the PlayStation 3 and the Vita, Hotline Miami, which I think has gotten pretty roundly... I don't know if I've ever heard anyone say anything bad about Hotline Miami. Hotline Miami is a pixelated, sort of top-down 2D murder simulator. In fact, it's a lot like the
Jack Thompson Lives.
It is a murder simulator. I mean, I'm trying to think of another game that is as much of a murder simulator as Hotline Miami is. But it's got kind of that distinctive look. It is very, twitchy, responsy kind of gameplay. And the idea is that you play as a, I don't know. You know what it kind of reminds me of? It kind of reminds me of the guy from Drive.
Yeah.
Where he's... the thing is, so the game is kind of like this weird, surreal kind of like pseudo-druggy experience. You start out in your house or your apartment, and you get these messages on your answering machine. Because they weren't called... It wasn't voicemail back then. You got answering machine, and you may have actually played your messages off of a little cassette tape. But he gets these like cryptic messages like, we're throwing a party down at 133rd and, you know, Vine Street or something, and we need you to come down and, you know, bring your murder face. I mean, they don't say that, but it's like these things. It's sort of like a code for something. And so you walk out of your house, you get in your car, and you drive to this other 2D sort of house or building layout, and it's filled with these dudes in like polyester suits And first of all, before you even do that, you put on these animal masks. So you're a dude in this Letterman jacket, and actually people generally refer to the guy as Jacket. No, it's very vague, this entire setup. But he puts on these animal masks, and then he goes to these houses or these buildings, and his job is to murder everybody. The game kind of plays a little bit like almost a puzzle-y kind of thing, because you are instantly lethal to everybody else, and everybody else is instantly lethal to you. And the kills are very graphic. So not only can you pick up baseball bats or crowbars, or you can get samurai swords, you know, katanas, but there also are guns, different kinds of guns, rifles and shotguns and things like that. And basically anything that hits you pretty well kills you. And if you hit someone, you pretty much kill them. Blood sprays everywhere. You can knock people down and then jump on them and, you know, hit X repeatedly to smash their face into the floor. You can curb stomp people if they're still alive, things like that. And part of the goal of the game is to clear the entire house without bringing down everybody else on you. So the melee kills are silent, basically. You can get knives and things like that. Or you can decide, you know what, screw it, get a shotgun. But the shotguns will alert people in the immediate vicinity in the adjoining rooms to where you are, and they'll basically swarm you. And you might still be able to get away with it. The thing about this is the game is very kind of dynamic. And it moves very quickly, too. And if you die, which you will die over and over again, it has a very sort of Meat Boy, Super Meat Boy kind of like immediate restart. So I'll find myself, and it has this very addictive quality to it. I don't know what it is. I didn't expect it to be quite, you know, let me just try it again. Oh, shit. Okay, let me try again. And, you know, my wife was sitting on the couch and I'm just like, ah. She's like, what are you doing over there? I'm like, I'm dying over and over again. But then I would have something I need to do, and I'll be like, okay, let me just see if I can clear this room. And it's kind of fun. I mean, you know, the same things don't happen twice. The people are kind of oblivious. Like, you can jump on a guy and smash him, and someone else can walk right by the room or see the blood spray, and they don't really notice. But it doesn't matter, because they are very responsive to you, too. If you walk into the room, you can't always use your Twitch, you know, reflexes to immediately, they'll get you sometimes. I mean, if they see you, it's pop and you're dead. So you have to try and sneak up on them. You can smack doors into them, so they'll do little circuits around their rooms, and you know, so you can, if you see a couple of guys sort of pacing a room, you can hit the door on the second guy. That'll kind of knock him out for a minute. Baseball bat the other dude in the face, smear his brains all over everything, jump on the other guy and throttle him to death. And, you know, and then search the room and see what else you've got in there that you can use to go to the next room. And it's, like I said, it's got kind of a cool sort of, the music in the game, a lot of people say it like it's one of the best soundtracks. I'm still kind of getting into it. It is very cool. It's got kind of a cross between hot chiptune kind of music and this cool psychedelic synth sort of thing going on. It is a very cool soundtrack, and it just adds to this weird, surreal kind of effect, because you never really know what's going on. You start to have conversations in between levels with these, they don't even really explain what they are, but these guys in, you know, this rooster mask, and a dude in an owl mask, and a dude in a horse mask, and they're giving you instructions and telling you these really weird cryptic things about, like, I'm going to make some predictions, and this is what's going to happen to you, and you won't know what this is about, but something's going to happen. And as you go through different levels, you can find other animal masks. So you start out with, like, I think it's a rooster mask, and then you can get other masks that give you different powers, or, you know, just different abilities. Like, you might get a mask that lets you survive a couple of bullets. You might get a mask that lets you, if you bang someone with a door, it might kill them instead of simply knocking them down. You can see little secret things, you know, little pickups and things. You can walk faster. But you basically get into this cycle of, you know, I'm going to get a new mask, and then I'm going to try and figure out this next building. And you just die over and over, immediate respawn, learn from it, try it again. Or if you're like me, you get so convinced that the way you're going to do it is the right way. And it is a little bit like that. Like, sometimes you figure out, like, okay, if I go down here, this dude is definitely going to see me. Oh, crap, those were see-through walls because they were glass. I just got shot again, so I can't go there first. I've got to go down and do these other dudes. And then the dog is going to come, and I got
to... Trial and error.
Yeah, there is a trial and error, but it just like Super Meat Boy or just like you know, some of these other games, it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, I would die Trials walking HD. Into the first room. Yeah, Trials is another good example, and I would die immediately stepping into the first room. Ah, okay, do it again. Ah, okay, all right, this time I'm sure I can get it. Ah, and then maybe sometime I like get this great baseball bat swing and take out two guys at once, and yes, and then I step out of that room and just got plugged by some other dude. And it doesn't matter. You just do it over and over again. And it never really got frustrating for me. And the vibe of the game is just very weird. I mean, it reminds me almost of like a Memento kind of. That's not a great example because that's all backwards. But what's something that it's like? I mean, Scanner Darkly or something?
What about Reload on the PS1? Wasn't that like kind of top-down?
Reloaded, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking more of the vibe of it. Yeah, just like you never really know what's going on. And in between missions, you'll go visit your friend. I guess he's your friend. I don't know.
Like Lynchian? David Lynch?
It is a little bit David Lynchy, but it's like more sinister. I mean, this is definitely like... I mean, David Lynch is... I guess he's got a little bit of a sinister element to him, but he's never really like murderous So this is definitely like, okay, I don't know what the shit is going on here, but I must be on some drugs, and you're sort of trying to figure it out. But you get through the game, and you can actually play this through in just a few hours. I mean, maybe 3 hours, maybe, to get through most of the missions if you sit down and play, and you'll get through a pretty good, you'll eventually figure it out pretty quickly. I understand that the Vita is the way to play this. I never played it on the PC, and I haven't really bothered even loading it. It is a cross-buy title, so it's $9, $9.99, $10, and you'll get both the Vita and the PS3 version, and it is cross-save also, so you can upload your save data and carry on. But I haven't really bothered on the PS3. I should probably try it. It has some nice touch controls. It's a twin stick sort of setup where you use the left stick to move and the right stick sort of faces you, and it moves so quickly that it's sometimes hard to, especially with guns, to like shoot. If you're doing a melee attack, like swinging a baseball bat, you have a pretty good arc that you're pretty well guaranteed to hit someone. But with guns, it's a little harder. The shotgun has a little bit of a spray, but if assault rifles, you got to be pretty much pointed right at people.
Is it 8-way or like a 360?
It's 360, so it is, you don't lock on to anything, except on the Vita, and I don't know how this worked on the PC or how it works on the PS3, but you can actually tap the screen on, and you can set up, because you can actually just sort of sit and sort of case a room and say, okay, these guys are going around in this circle or whatever, and so you can actually tap on a target, and it will automatically face you at that person no matter where they move. So you can sometimes use that if you've got a couple of guys following each other. You can like tap on the first dude, and then as soon as they're lined up just so, kick the door down and shoot in that general direction and smear them both. So that works pretty well. You can also swipe the screen or kind of swipe your finger along and kind of look at, kind of move the map around to kind of see what is outside of your immediate field of vision. Which is kind of cool. So it is at once both a sort of thoughtful, puzzly style game combined with a really fast-paced, twitch reflex kind of action game. Like I said, you can try it over and over, learn through trial and error. It's a little bit like I would almost like it's kind of like Hotline Miami is the Dark Souls of Grand Theft Auto 2. to use the dark, the Dark Souls of this or that. Hotline Miami is the Dark Souls of Grand Theft Auto 2, basically, where it's all top down and stuff. There's also so you can finish it in a couple hours. There's a new game plus. You can kind of figure out the story, but I don't know if the story even makes sense. Maybe there is. It's one of those things where it's like if you watched a movie and you're like, I don't know what just happened. It's kind of like that. But this is so much fun, and it has such a. I mean, everybody makes squishy sounds when you kill them, and it's just kind of this really satisfying squish when you get someone. and like I said, you can also like jump on them and just keep hitting X, smash, smash, smash. Sometimes it'll only take two hits to smash someone's face open. Sometimes it takes three or four. And while you're smashing someone down, someone else might come in on you. So you're like, oh crap, got to pick up the crowbar again and take them on. But anyway, it is basically what everybody has said about it. Everybody that you've heard talking about Hotline Miami. A lot of fun, and for $10 to get two different versions of it, I'd say it's at least worth looking into. I don't think there's a demo, but take a look at some videos of it in action, and if you could probably tell pretty quickly if it's going to work for you. But the 80s vibe is very cool. I don't know about anybody else who played it, but you start out between missions in your apartment every time, and he has a little NES there. I mean, I swear it looks like an NES, and I try and go up to the NES and play it every time, like hit X, but it doesn't really work. But it does have that kind of, I know, it has kind of that retro
City Rampage.
Yeah.
That's another overhead shooter.
That same vein, except whereas in that, you know, people would just kind of fall over and blink until they disappear.
Right.
I mean, there is blood spray in this, and it's pretty satisfying blood spray. I don't know if I've seen blood spray quite as good as this in this style of game before. So
is this a family friendly game?
You know, I want my wife to try it because I was telling her about it, and I'm like, you know, it's this murder simulator, and she's like, oh, great. But I almost wonder if she would kind of like it because, like I said, it is a little bit puzzling. She probably won't like it. I this is definitely not like the kind of thing that a casual person would probably get into. But I want her to try it and see if she even gets it a little bit. But yeah, it is pretty explicit. No language. It's just the blood, and the fact that you're bashing people's faces in with crowbars and stuff. Which are they seem to be lying around those buildings pretty freely too. These crowbars. I don't know where they get all those.
It's a tire shop.
It is, yeah. I think these guys are supposed to be like Russian mafiosos or something.
Oh yeah, those guys carry, you know, tire irons all over the place.
Yeah, and you unlock new weapons, so eventually you can get like glass bottles that you can throw at people. And
I think they use them to decorate.
Yeah, yeah.
The Russian mafia. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Hotline Miami, it's a good one, and it was just recently released. So if you play it right now, you won't be too late to the party. So that's one. The other thing I've been playing also on the Vita is Tokyo Jungle Mobile, which
yes.
Weeks ago, yes, show favorite tech gaming podcast, mm-hmm. Show favorite Tokyo Jungle, yes, has been translated to PS Mobile, and I was trying to decide whether I wanted to say out loud for the show that it is the better version. I don't know. So don't hold me to that. But let's talk a little bit about it. So Tokyo Jungle the First was basically a vaguely 3D. It had 3D depth, but it was sort of 2D-ish, kind of survival game where you'd have to navigate the streets of Tokyo and find food, find a mate, and basically survive as long as you could. Tokyo Jungle
Mobile. Don't forget humping.
Yeah. Well, so we'll get to that. So in the PlayStation Mobile version, they have basically turned it into an isometric 3D. If you look at the screenshots of it, I know before it came out, a lot of people were saying, oh, it's going to be like Final Fantasy Tactics, like it's turn-based. And I was like, oh, yeah, turn-based. It's actually not turn-based. It's real-time, but it is grid-based. So the way it works is you have basically static sprites, I guess you would call them, just little art, you know, here's an art of a dog. And you basically move from square to square in this grid, and you know each of the areas is sort of shaped a little bit different, but it's basically a grid that you jump on. And every time you move, you see it sort of animates like this little hop, 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 hop. So it's very basic in that standpoint, but all of the other animals, whether they are other predators, whether they are your prey, they are moving around themselves as well and looking in different directions and kind of moving sometimes. You can still go in and hide in the grass, hop into grass, and it's very simplified there because if you're in that grass, you're basically invisible to anybody, even if they were just chasing you. And you can then at that point decide whether you're going to attack them. So it still does the you know, the bloody jaws kind of thing that fades in, and you can get an instant kill, or you can escape or do whatever you need to. In this game, there is survival mode only. So there was a story mode in the original Tokyo Jungle. Here it's just survival mode, so there's no story. You can still get little pickups and things, but it basically is streamlined to just a very straightforward, you're going to see how long you can last kind of mode. All of the animals from the original game are in this. In fact, even the DLC, the ones that you actually were paid DLC in the PlayStation game, they actually have those animals here as well. You still need to unlock them, but they are not separate purchases. The controls are simplified, so you basically have your four cardinal directions. You can flip which way north is, kind of. So if you put your stick, you know, to the left, you can say, well, I'm going to move this way or that way. But other than that, the only other control that you really do is you hit the X button to attack. You can use circle, I believe, to dodge. But other than that, marking your territory is automatic. If you move onto a grid space with a flag, you'll mark that as yours. You auto eat plants. So if you're an herbivore, if you jump onto a plant, it will automatically eat it. But predation, you know, carnivorous activity, you still have to attack and hit X to do that. couple of other things that are different in this, they don't have a stamina meter. So before you could do some extra jumping maneuvers and things, and if you were in combat, you could do little dodges. They don't bother with stamina here. So you're basically just looking at your life meter and your hunger meter. And the hunger meter moves super fast in this. I do not remember the hunger moving quite as quickly in the full version of this. And I actually think it works really well because it keeps you moving. You don't have a lot of downtime in this. I mean, you're going to get hungry pretty quickly. And then the fact that there's no stamina meter, you're basically always working on your objectives. I mean, you're going to attack, you're going to run, or you're going to follow whatever the current, you know, it'll tell you go to this territory, go to that territory, whatever. Also, the process of finding mates is streamlined. So there are basically, you'll just come across, you know, another deer or another lion or something, and they'll have a pink heart if it's a normal or an elite female, or it'll have a black heart if it's a desperate female. And it's kind of different in this because the way it worked in the other one was you could sort of choose what you wanted to do. Like, you could come across a desperate female and decide, you know what, I just need to procreate here. let's get it on. Or you can decide, you know what, I think I can get a few more K-cals, I can eat a few more things and rank up, and then I can get a better female. With this, the desperate female, if you come onto an area that has one of those, they will come to get you, and if they touch you or if you touch them, that's it. You're monogamous. That, you know, you're in.
and more ways than one.
Yeah, well, so that's the other thing in this, is the mating in this. So To great detail in the last show, when we talked about Tokyo Jungle, we talked about how you would, you know, they would assume the position and you'd
fade
sort
to black.
Of, yeah, exactly. Fade to black. And
yeah, and howl.
Exactly. In this, it
was
is
it down, mate, howl, fade to black?
It was sort of simultaneous fade to black and howl, I think. Yeah. But it left most of it to the imagination. Here in Tokyo Jungle Mobile, they have lascivious bumping sprites. There is no fading to black in this game. So in the same way that your little sprite hop, hop, hops to do different things, they'll bump each other. I mean, they bump, 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 and then, you know, the screen changes or whatever. I was scandalized to see this. I mean, they're not animated in any way except that the things are moving and bumping, but I'm like, oh my God.
It's kind of like that Paper Mario screwing Princess Peach gif. One up.
It's just bouncing, though. Like, they just kind of bounce off. And I, you know, I think even one time I was playing with my children and I was like, oh my, I don't want them to see that. The funny thing is that if you have a desperate female, instead of you bumping on her, she bumps backward into you, which is kind of a funny little, you know, I don't know what to make of that. But it kind of made me laugh. But yeah, it is downright, it is dirty.
It's like, I mean, the Discovery Channel song.
The Bad Touch, yes.
Yeah, Bad Touch, yes. Bad Touch,
yes. So the other thing, they actually
thank
did
you
also,
for that reference, Jeremy. That was haunting me for a good minute.
That's got to be some of the intro or outro music is the
yes.
version of Bad Touch. But they also changed the formula a little bit, where in the first game, and I went back to look at this, but I'm pretty sure that in the original PSN version, you basically always had one character model. So if you were a lion, you were a full-grown lion, and that was it. And you could get your K-Cal's mate, and then your offspring would also be a full-grown lion with a few siblings, maybe. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure that's how it worked. In this, though, they actually have, since I guess they don't have to bother with character models, they just have these little, you know,
sprites,
non-animated things. You actually start out as a young version of the animal. So if
you're
a lion
from The Lion King.
Yeah, you start out as a little lion cub with, you know, no mane, and you're just all alone in the world. And then you actually have to, if you want to produce a new generation or change the map. And there are reasons to do that. I mean, eventually you start running out of food or, you know, whatever, and you just have to level up. You have to get out of that. So you do that by moving to a new generation, and it basically resets the map for you. So what you do is you mark the territory, and then you actually have to sleep on the nest first, and then you become the mature version of that animal, at which point then your next thing is to get the calories again and then find a mate, and then you can progress from there. And again, it all just moves very quickly. I mean, it's kind of neat as a mobile game. I can see how they've sort of changed or streamlined the game to make it just very, you know, very driven. You know, you're getting hungry, you have your objectives, and go to it.
Well, was there like cars and things? Like I always liked hopping on the cat on the car.
Yeah, no, they don't have
that
easy
target.
Yeah, you can't interact with the terrain or with objects in the terrain. They do have, you know, like sometimes you'll go into a place that has increasing elevation. You know, there's a park. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes the grid will it'll jump up a level, but there's not really any gameplay significance to that. It's just kind of aesthetically, you know, you're starting to go up or you're starting to go down. Also, the maps seem to be a little bit better interconnected. Like I would find myself getting lost sometimes in the PSN version. Mm-hmm. Here the map is laid out very straightforward. You can go the long way around to get to the two edges, or there's a sewer shortcut that you can take in between. And so I found myself actually surviving a lot longer in this. And again, just the way that they've streamlined the Tokyo Jungle experience in this, I think they've done a very good job with it. And like I said, the other thing is that it's on your Vita, it's on your Xperia Play, if you have one of those. Somebody else. If you have an Xperia Play, write into the show. Because I want to know who you are if you have an Xperia Play. If you can play PlayStation mobile games on a phone, on an actual phone, give us a jingle. But it's just you can just boot it up on your Vita, play it for a few minutes, and be done. And so just in that same way that portable games have that kind of appeal, Tokyo Jungle Mobile works on that level as well. But like I said, it streamlines very well, and I think they did a very good job adapting it for mobile. It is. I don't think there are any other adaptations like that to compare it to, but it is a great adaptation of the PSN game. So, yeah, I recommend it. It's $6 on PlayStation Mobile, so it is one of the higher priced items. But again, if you have any interest in Tokyo Jungle, if you have a Vita or another PlayStation Mobile compatible Android device, it's worth looking into. I would definitely recommend it. I've had a lot of fun with it. I mean, if only for the lascivious bumping sprites. So there you have it. So Tokyo Jungle Mobile. The last thing I want to give just a quick little mention to is the new DLC for Guacamelee. El DLC nuevo, señor, de Guacamelee, del videojuego Guacamelee para el PlayStation Vita. $2.99. It's basically a bunch of challenge rooms, but I actually had a lot of fun with it. It adds a new area to the Guacamelee map, Infierno, which means hell. You actually get to go to, if you've played Guacamelee, you know that Carlos Calaca, the villain, has ousted El Diablo from Infierno. So if you're learning some Spanish here as we go along. And so it's kind of funny, too, because it's full of references, this game, and you actually go to a place that's kind of, it's sort of like EA. It kind of looks like the EA logo, and they're in hell, and all these people have balls and chains on. but you go through these challenge rooms, which can have different objectives. Some of them are melee. Some of them are platforming challenges. Do it in a certain time limit. Get a certain number of combo hits. You'll remember from the previous show where we talked about Guacamelee, I think everybody really liked it, and we love the combo system. There's something really satisfying about that simple combat in Guacamelee that translates into a really deep combo attack system. And so I had a lot of fun. I think everybody has advertised this, or when you see it advertised on websites, it's like, oh my god, it's so difficult. But if you got very far in Guacamelee and sort of got to master that melee system, to me, I think it got to be a lot more fun than difficult. So I would have to do some of the challenge rooms. I think there are 17 challenge rooms in this. So for $3, 17 challenge rooms, and you unlock medals, bronze, silver, gold medals. And with those medals, you can then unlock new costumes. So they had also released some costume DLC for Guacamelee. In this one, they have a couple of them that actually are really handy because they have special abilities. El Portero, which is a soccer goalie, and he's good at throwing. The Alebrije, which if you played Guacamelee, there is a big colorful monster, which is based on the painted porcelain figures of Mexico. He has extreme damage, which actually works really well for time melee attacks in those. Just a little hint there. And the Diablo suit, which is basically just one with some devil horns, but he has life draining abilities as well. And like I said, for $3, it's if you like Guacamelee, and if you played Guacamelee, you should like it. Otherwise, your taste is terrible. So for $3, the challenge rooms, they're pretty good. One word of caution, though, on the Guacamelee DLC, I have found it to be a little bit buggy. Yeah, I've talked a little bit to Drinkbox Studios about it. There actually were two rooms that I actually could not complete due to bugs. However, mm-hmm. I was still able to unlock all of the costumes, notwithstanding that. So be aware that they are potentially going to be updating things. So, for example, there was one where you're supposed to be able to wall climb and do a special, you know, super fly off of that. And there's apparently an old debug room exit there, so it sort of renders the wall unusable, so you couldn't finish the platforming. And then I kept locking up at the very last challenge room. So kind of be aware of that, but the extra costumes and just the challenge and fun of you know, the melee combat and the platforming. Guacamelee was just so tight, you know, it just did a really good job at both of those things. And I think these challenge rooms are representative of that. So I was able to do those challenge rooms in just a, you know, day or two, just kind of casually playing through. And like I said, for $3, it's probably worth looking into. And there you have it.
Yay.
Así es la vida.
Bugs in the guacamole.
Bugs in the guacamole. Bugs in the
tea. Bugs in the verde salsa.
Salsa verde. Ay, 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 ay.
Robert here, and today I've got 3.5 Samurais, Chad, Eugene, Octavio, and Vic, who are on hand to talk about their debut title, which is Cake Nana. So welcome to the Tech Gaming Podcast, everyone.
Thank you, sir.
Hello.
Thank
you.
Yeah, great for you to come on. Now, before we get to Nana, let's get a little background on 3.5 Samurai. Tell me about your team, and perhaps maybe your collective or your individual aspirations.
Okay, well, 3.5 Samurai actually got unofficially started in February of 2011, so it's been going on for quite some time. We didn't actually found the company until March 2012, so a little over a year now that the company's been officially founded. Some of the reasons why we got together was we kind of had an idea of what made us happy, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have our own jobs and everything, separate jobs. And that's perfectly fine. But the big thing for us was what's really our passion? What do we enjoy doing?
Mm-hmm.
And then it ended up turning into, well, it's not really related to what we're doing in our full-time jobs.
Right.
So that ended up being related to gaming, mm-hmm. anime. And we really wanted to merge those things together. And so we put together a team that all had similar aspirations. And I know that Eugene is an avid gamer, Octavio is an avid gamer, and Vic is also very well involved into gaming. So that's kind of our universal connection there together.
Cool. Now one thing, I'm always stuck on titles, so let's talk about them. First 3.5 Samurai, obviously a reference to Kurosawa's masterpiece, Seven Samurai. Right?
Not even comments. Not yet.
are you half of Kurosawa's masterpiece? But Cake Nana kind of threw me for a loop. I know in Japanese, Nana can be, I think it's seven, or apple. Spanish, slang for grandmother. I think in Hawaiian, it's a month in spring. And in Tagalog, I think it's just pus. So, so which is it? Is it pus?
Does it translate seven? Well?
I like Cake Pus. That's a good name. That's something I would download immediately.
Well, so it's mm-hmm. like the name Cake Nana is actually related to none of those. It basically just came up as the idea of I was just talking with like a coworker one day, and we were just thinking, wouldn't it be really cool if cakes grew on trees and they would be like inside a banana, mm-hmm. and you can call them Cake Nana? Oh. Yeah, that's really just where the name came from. Like, that would grow like a banana.
Oh, I like that. I'm flushing all my theories down the toilet as we speak. those were all awful. So now, talking to you and a few other members of the 3.5 Samurai team, I got a different impression than most indie developers that talk to you guys at Anime Expo. And quite often I'll meet teams that have a really great product, but they either don't know or don't care to promote it. And you guys had a nice draw of attendees at Anime Expo and were really good at promoting the title. What is your secret?
So the idea that we really had was that it's more so about the enjoyment and the fun factor of what the game really means.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order for us to really get the same feeling that we have about the game to other people, it was more so about getting that excitement going. It was more so about getting the enjoyment going, bringing them to the table, and then watching them and experiencing the happiness that they get from playing the game. And it was really not the difficult thing for us to really come up with. It was just a matter of, we just need to show how we feel about the game, and it brought the people to us.
Now, let's talk about the concept. Did a single person come up with the idea for the game, or was it more of a collaborative effort?
I would say that the initial idea started off with one or two people, but then once we all started thinking about it, it was just idea after idea being thrown out there. And honestly, I think we went through 4 to 5 different versions of what Cake Nod would actually be before we ended up on where we're at.
Now, last August, you guys attempted to kickstart financing for Cake Nod. But sadly, everyone probably misspent their disposable income on the Pebble Watch and Ouya. Like myself, my Pebble Watch broke today. How difficult was it for the team to bounce back after the campaign ended?
So the main thing with Kickstarter was that it was more so to help accelerate the process that we were going through, because the initial feedback from Anime Expo 2012, actually, that was really just a testing ground. It was a proving ground for us. And it really, it showed how much interest there is for the idea that we had. And there wasn't any limitation on the amount of ideas and effort that we could put into it. It was more so about, how much money do we have to get things out as fast as possible so that people can enjoy this?
Mm-hmm. Cool. So now that the game is completed and available in the App Store, can you give me a brief overview of the game for our listeners that may not be familiar with it?
Sure. Yeah, Gene, you want to take that one?
Sure. Cake Nana is basically a combination of tower defense. And we wanted to add like storyline and RPG feel into it. So basically, like for anyone who's familiar with tower defense, they should be able to pick this right up. You are like, one big difference is you are the tower, and you are just here to protect the kingdom of Cake Nana from oncoming waves of ants. And basically, with the game, you will have different weapons to choose from and different special abilities and to deal with different types of ants.
Now, you mentioned the tower, and the listeners, of course, can't see, but you guys really have this saccharine sweet visual motif. So what makes Cake Nana different from, say, other defense-oriented, defense-style mobile titles?
I think just to start off, even with, we really went for more of a hybrid of several different key types of games. We really wanted to introduce more of an RPG feel to it too, because we felt like we had this amazing story that we wanted to tell. But if we just stuck with a simple tower defense inspired game, then we wouldn't be able to tell that story. And so I think something that sets us apart is the fact that there really is a much larger story behind the entire game. The gameplay itself is addicting and fun, but the story itself behind it, it's really a larger thing.
We're hoping. And also, Oh, and also when we're working on the levels, we wanted to do more than just like your typical tower defense where you just place towers and then there's armies come and then you just watch your towers destroy them. Yeah. Instead, we want people to be able to actively interact with the environment. Mm-hmm. And also, like, there's going to be situations where they have to choose like the best strategy to stop the incoming waves. Like, it will definitely not just be simple like point and shoot.
Sure. So it's a little bit of a puzzle aspect thrown in there as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Now, speaking of graphics, one of the first things I said when I demoed the game at this year's Anime Expo, and you're probably sick of hearing, is, wow, this game reminds me of Sugar Rush from Wreck-It Ralph. Now, I know the team's been working on the game long before the Pixar movie was revealed, but what is – talk to me about overcoming that that impression from people.
It's actually pretty funny, too, because in the middle of all of our redesigns for the levels and the backgrounds and everything, mm-hmm. that's when the movie came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to the team about saying, oh, my God, Pixar just copied us. I'm like, there's no way to prove that. But we already had the graphics that we wanted. It was the exact idea that we had in our minds for what we wanted to show.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of seeing the visual aspect of that in the Wreck-It Ralph movie, mm-hmm. it was almost like an inspiration, because it was the world that we were envisioning in our heads was being displayed on this animated side.
Yeah. And I also thought with Bug's Life, they kind of ripped off Kurosawa. No one said anything about that, though. Now, since Kiknana is a free game, how is monetization implemented? How are you guys going to make your money back?
Well, Bic is the specialist there in the episode, so if you want to talk about that.
Okay, with Kiknana, there's two different ways that, we're going to try to make our money back. You know, our freemium games, right? That's what pretty much we're kind of the style game we're going for is. So the game's completely free, and then if you want to accelerate your progress or just, beat the game or overcome certain obstacles quicker, you can just buy gems to help upgrade your weapons,
sure,
and your items and get more HP. So that just makes the games. Also, it just makes it easier to play. So if you're a light gamer, but you some of the levels might be too challenging, then you could do that too. So when you purchase those gems, you're going to pretty much paying for them, and that what we'll get money from. And then the second is we'll also have ads. So mm-hmm. we'll just have light ads here and there, and of course any click-throughs and things like that, then we'll get money from that.
Hmm. Okay, so
I would like to point out that the gems that Big is talking about, mm-hmm. they are earned in the game as well.
Okay.
So there's multiple ways to earn them. One of them is just simply to beat the levels. You'll earn gems based on your performance. And another one is you'll earn coins throughout the game, and you can convert those to gems. So for anyone who wants, they can play the game completely free.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not
paid. There's a point of that, G.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. So if you have a lot of time on your hands or you're really good at games, you can definitely earn your way to the top just by playing it.
Okay.
You don't need to, doesn't force you to pay anything extra.
Now, one last question. What's next for 3.5 Samurai?
That's a good question.
You guys mentioned the app in the Google Play Store?
Yeah. So in the nearest term, we're working hard to launch Kiknana to Google Play and also to Amazon App Store.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other things that we are looking at are with Ouya and publishing there too, and right after that we're looking to make sure that we launch an additional kingdom, which will have many more levels.
And how will that be delivered,
Gene? How would that be delivered?
The additional kingdoms, it would just be a update to the game itself.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
Yeah, okay. So it's no extra cost or anything.
Cool. Very cool. Well, Chad, Eugene, Octavio, Bic, I want to thank you so much for your time and want to wish you and the rest of the team the best of luck.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello and welcome to Indie Outlook, where big ideas come from smaller developers. I am Robert Desert Eagle Allen, and along with me is Sai.
Hello.
Hello. Sai, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Why'd your voice crack?
Puberty.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
What do I know?
One day I'll get there and finally get some facial hair. No, my question is, how can you tell a indie developer from a larger studio?
That's a really good question.
Is it? Now,
maybe.
If I were to answer that, I would say you are truly indie when Metacritic flubs your name. And what I'm talking about, is Wive and Keep Temple of the Lost Idol, which comes from a developer by the name of Jolly Corpse. Now, unfortunately, Metacritic and a few other sites, they misspelled the studio's name. Can you guess how they misspelled it?
Oh, boy. A Lolly Corpse?
Yes, a Lolly Corpse, which is definitely a taboo subject on this podcast.
Is it? But you love lollies.
Yes, I like them alive. But inadvertent misspelling aside, Wiv and Keep, it's a single-player cooperative puzzle platformer, which was released on Desoor last month, and definitely inspired by titles such as Adventures of Lolo, Lost Vikings.
It's Adventures of what?
Lolo.
I heard lollies.
Oh, no. You know, like lovers only live once.
That's taking an effect for you.
Yes.
Okay.
So let's move on with those tentacles. Wiv and Keep, it's
Wait,
well made.
What?
I was kidding. I was
okay, joking. Sorry.
It's well made and a fun little game, which makes me long for a remake of Wizard for the Commodore 64. Did you ever play that one, that gem?
Yes.
You did. Oh, I spent a whole summer playing that. So anyway, main characters, Wiv and Keep, they're stranded adventurers who happen to be polar opposites. Wiv is the meathead male. He finds ancient texts and he wants to wipe his butt with them because he thinks they're paper.
What?
Yes, Keep is the intellectual.
That's a beautiful description then.
Keep is the intellectual. She understands the importance of these ancient writings and she also gets to wear a nice little witch hat. The duo can be pretty chatty, but players who want to get down to the puzzling can just fast forward through the prattle. Each of the game's 60 stages, they're single rooms, and what they do is they task one of the members with making their way to the exit door. And standing in the way of that are boxes which can be pushed to create jump pads. There's pressure switches and the occasional enemy. And as such, the duo, they really have to carefully manipulate things just right to make it out alive, which demands usually a couple tries as you get later in the game. And if you're
feeling... How are the puzzles, by the way?
They start moderately difficult in the, say, the teens, and then they get pretty tricky. And a single wrong move or two will definitely lead to your death. But
game looks beautiful.
Yeah, it does. It's got a pixelated art style. I really like the pixelated bamboo, and it's got different. Oh, and the music is really phenomenal, which is great. I've been listening to that all morning. And if you're feeling adventurous, you can collect the loot in the levels. It's largely superfluous. You don't have to, but it will add to your score.
But it counts
to replay. Yeah. Yeah, if you want to replay the levels, yeah. So,
let's
what makes...
Loots.
Yeah, what makes Wiv and Keep... Huh? You all right there?
But yeah, I think you channel one of the Lost Vikings, Olaf, for Valhalla. Anyway, what makes Wyvern Keep unique are the options. Two people can play locally, one on the old WASD keys, the other using the arrow keys to move along.
Oh, both of them which you hate.
I love the arrow keys.
Oh, shut up.
They use the shift key to jump.
Hating on PC gaming.
There's four lovers. There's online multiplayer, which you can only communicate via text chat, unless you fire up Skype. I think it would be an interesting experiment to play via text chat. Single players, they can enjoy the regular game or an easy variant, and that removes some of the intricacies of each stage. Unfortunately, some of the later puzzles in the game, they require near-perfect synchronization between the characters, which can feel a little bit like juggling if you're alone. So I definitely.
What do you mean?
Meaning you have to position one character here, and then something happens, then you have to move the other character, and it's just a little tricky to kind of juggle both characters. So I definitely recommend the game to pairs. And along with the 60 stages, there's a really nice, robust level editor. And you can even import your own bitmaps, so you can reskin the stages to your liking. You could you can make Sonic like the Green Hill Zone or something like that, which would be a nice backdrop. So, you know, that adds a little helping of longevity to this already really cool title. So that's right. Wyvern Keep. Definitely a keeper.
My lolly corpses.
Jolly, jolly. Speaking of jolly, I want to get my jollies hearing about Element 4.
Yeah, we've got Elemental today. Elemental or Element 4L, as some call it as well. It's this very whimsical platformer in which you get to play with only four keys, which transforms you into a rock.
Are they was there?
Yeah, why? Are you going to hate on it?
No, I'm stoned.
Which transforms you into rock, water, ice, and fire. And this is exactly what is going to allow you to move through. It's a cutesy kind of game with some sort of a learning curve. There's not much to the premise, but the fact that you just team up with elements in a quest for life. The gameplay, well, you don't get to fully control the character as it is. You have got to go through the motions. And what you get to control is somehow how gravity affects you. This makes for quite a very complicated gameplay at first. I do admit when I got started, I died way too many times.
So when you're rock, you descend, and when you're one of the other elements, you
when you're water,
ascend.
You float, and when you're fire, you get to slide through. And
oh, okay. That's cool.
So, I mean, yeah, every single element has got a limitation and it's got a quality that is just going to allow you to go through.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to learn how to adapt into the elements and what will fit best to move forward. And as I said, some of the puzzles are fairly simple, but some are really unforgiving. The art, yeah, it kind of reminds me of Limbo. There's big areas, big black areas, and only just this one has got bright colors contrasting in the background. The music of the game has got to be my favorite part of the whole thing.
Can you hum a few bars?
The what?
Can you hum a few bars?
Why are you trolling me?
I'll stop.
If you sing, I'll sing. Otherwise, fuck that. So, but once you bring together the art and the music and everything, it's a really, really stylish game. It's really beautiful. The concept is pretty simple. You just get to move forward, combining the gameplay into the elements and their limitations. The goal as you go by is to collect lost sparks in order to, you know, get to the final part of the puzzle, which is, you know, finding the soul part. They are about 16 levels. And it also has a competitive mode to go with it. But since I really sucked at it, I didn't even give it a try in the competitive mode because it was really hard at first. Anyways, yes, the game, I could say, is charming and clever. That's, for me, the best way to describe it. There's no question about this. But I do admit this is not the kind of game for everyone. In fact, if I remember correctly, in the promo trailer, they say something like, there's no guns, there's no enemies, it's just do not expect a walk in the park. And yeah, that much is true. Beautiful all around, music, art, and even the concept. Just keep in mind that the game has got a steep learning curve. That's what I have to say.
So it kicked your butt.
Maybe. And if you were to play with someone like you, you would be cheating, I'm sure. I don't know how, but you would just cheat.
I'll just wait. Cheating. I'll just wait at the exit and let you do all the work.
You know what? Fuck
off. There you have it.
I did not wait at the exit.
You did. Rush.
No,
Brothers.
I did not.
The
Stop
audience
that.
Heard it last episode. Sure. Anyway, that concludes this episode of Indie Outlook. See you guys next
Bye.
Time. You guys ready for trivia?
Trivia!
We're ready.
Okay. As long as it's not about Pikmin.
Oh, that's okay. It's about Madden this week.
Ah, crap.
Just kidding, Jeremy.
I kind of like the Madden trivia.
Liar. Next week sees the release of Pikmin 3, the colorful real-time strategy title, which was originally destined to be published during the Wii U's launch window. Players shouldn't fret too much over the delay, considering it's been a while since the last game in the franchise. Just how many years did players have to wait between Pikmin 2 and Pikmin 3? 11 years, 9 years, 8 years, or 6 years?
Okay, now question. Are we counting the Wii release?
No, the original.
The new play control?
No.
I think it's
we're going to
years.
Pretend that didn't exist, and that wasn't a moneymaker for Reggie.
You know, I wonder if I should have played that, because being that the controls actually work really well on Pikmin 3 with a pointer, I kind of wonder if I shouldn't have played the Pikmin re-release.
I think the first one was pretty good. I didn't play a lot of it, but the pointer controls worked really well. I got it on clearance at Kmart for like $5.
The number 2002 comes to mind, and I...
Yeah.
It seems like that was kind of like a later title, though, because it got scarce kind of quickly.
I feel like Pikmin 1 and 2 came out like boom, boom, one right after the other, so I'm going to also go 2002.
And like Metroid Prime 2 was kind of around there, too, and was that 2002? I don't even remember. Anyway, I'm going to say 11 years.
Okay, everyone says 11 years. Correct answer.
I was actually going to say 9 years.
Correct answer, 9 years. I thought you were good jumping on the 11, Blue.
Okay.
Sorry. Number 2, Pikmin 3 adds a few new creatures to the mix. Name the two that aren't in the game. Okay, so 2. A, Rock Pikmin, which is used to smash through tougher barriers and glass. B, Rubber Pikmin, which can bounce their buddies over obstacles. C, Winged Pikmin, who can attack airborne enemies and carry items through the air. Or Orange Pikmin, which are capable of making plants grow at accelerated rates.
Ooh. I'm pretty sure Rock Pikmin are a thing, and Winged Pikmin would be pretty interesting, too.
Rubber Pikmin.
I think Rubber Pikmin and Tang Orange Colored Pikmin.
Not Cheeto Pikmin?
Or Doritos... Nachos, Locos, Taco thing.
Oh my god, I want one of those so bad.
Yeah.
That's a disgusting. Jeremy?
I agree with Blue on that. I know for sure. I actually went to one of the Wii U events here that they had locally. So, yeah, there are Rock Pikmin.
And... So you got ingrained.
Yeah, I got it. Game
Did
of the year.
Recon. 10 out okay, of 10. Correct answer. Yes, Rubber Pikmin and Orange Pikmin do not exist.
But they're the most delicious ones.
Yes. No, number three, what is the name given to Pikmin 3's multiplayer mode? Now you guys know this because you did your Pikmin recon. Is it the Garden Arena, Pick and Choose, Battle Bingo, or Take Your Pick?
Battle Bingo.
I kind of think it's Battle Bingo, too. That name kind of jumped out at me.
It kind of jumped out at me, too, but I'll be honest, I don't actually know, so I'll just go with these guys.
You didn't like Pick and Choose or Take Your Pick?
I don't think they make pick puns.
If I worked for Nintendo, they damn well would be. Correct answer, Battle Bingo.
Yeah. Like Bingo!
All picked out, then let's move on to some Vanillaware trivia in honor of Dragon's Crown. It's the studio's first HD game. You probably know that Dragon's Crown wasn't cheap to make. In fact, the game was Vanillaware's most expensive title to date. Just how much was the budget in U.S. dollars? $5 million, $3 million, $2 million, or $1 million?
Is this counting the amount of money they spent on hookers that they used as
I'm going to ignore this comment.
No.
Does it count the amount of extra money they spent on George Camatani to draw extra butts and boobs?
Hey, ink's more expensive than blood.
It is?
Printer ink, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll go with $2 million.
I'm going to be bold and say $5 million.
Is this going to be in yen or dollars?
Dollars.
I said in U.S. dollars.
In U.S. dollars. Did you give us choices, or are we just guessing? I'm going to say five.
5, 3, 2, and 1.
I was going to say 5. I'm going with 5.
Okay, correct answer.
$1.
Yeah, I knew it couldn't be 5, because, I mean, Atlas's parent company is selling for $151 million, so...
Speaking of Atlas, they're poised to enjoy some financial success from Dragon's Crown, but at least two other companies had the option to publish the game. Name them. A, Capcom and Sega. B, Capcom and Ignition. C, Ignition and NIS. D, Ignition and Konami.
Ooh.
I think Sean knows this.
Say Ignition and NIS.
I was kind of going to say that, because I think those are the thing about Atlas is they're primarily like a publisher, right? So... Yeah. Companies that already can publish, like publish a lot, like Capcom and Konami and stuff like that, I don't know that they would really find that all that beneficial. That may be faulty reasoning, but...
Well, and Ignition already had a history with Vanillaware before they decided to stop publishing games so much.
Actually duck out of the market. Near.
Yeah.
I guess I'll agree with Ignition and NIS. It does seem like something that up both companies' alleys.
Correct answer, Capcom and Ignition.
That makes sense. Capcom's like the remix to Ignition.
And,
Fish Out the Kitchen.
Yes.
And they just fired a bunch of people, so they've got a lot of money laying around.
The president of Vanillaware, he did... the Dungeons and Dragons game Jeremy was just talking about. He was behind that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that means I'm kind of right with my answer.
No, you're 100% wrong.
Want me to troll you more?
Less.
Less?
Yes.